everybody. We're now going to begin the public hearing on the proposed rules we've got on interconnection. And, of course, those were noticed. We're in room 413 here in the state capitol. The date is May 6, 2009, and the time is 9:30 in the morning. All right, anybody interested in presenting data, opinions, and arguments for or against the proposed rules may do so today by appearing in person at this hearing or by sending them to the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission, 500 East Capitol in Pierre. Material sent by mail must reach the PUC by May 18, 2009 to be considered. The commission will consider all written and oral comments it receives on the proposed rules. The commission may modify or amend a proposed rule at that time to include or exclude matters that were described in the public notice. So with that, let's go ahead and take comments. I don't think we need to structure this in any particularly formal way other than I would just note that when you're referring to a specific rule, please mention which one so we can all get on the same page and follow along. So with that, who's first in line? All right, Ms. Semler.
This is Kara Semler for staff. I guess just as an opening remark, I think you'll probably hear some arguments today that will further a particular interest that these individuals and companies may have. Staff's here today to represent and support the process that took place, the variety of workshops, and also here today to represent that the rules that we are working with today do represent a negotiation and a compromise by both sides of the arguments you may hear today. So with that, we'll be here for any questions, but we support the process and the negotiation in the form of the current rules.
That is a very good overview. Ms. Semler, could you just quickly remind us of that process?
I don't have the dates in mind, but it was some time ago that we began discussing this in front of the commission just from a very broad policy perspective, if this commission is interested or not in having interconnection rules in general. And the commission decided it was. So from there, the commission asked for staff to take on a workshop process to try to gather the thoughts of all of the interested parties. And we held, the first workshop was an in-person workshop, and we held that in Pierre, had great attendance. All of the parties that are here today were represented well at that first workshop. The following three workshops occurred on a web-based format over the internet and telephone. We broke the rules down. We broke the issues down, dealt with them one by one, and, as I stated, came to the compromise that we presented in the rules.
Perfect. Great. Thanks. With that, Mr. Willard, moving toward the mic. Just as a reminder for everybody, we're on the web, and this will be archived for all time, so speak slowly and into the microphone and let us know who you are before you begin talking. Thanks. Do we have the mic on, Mr. Willard?
Good morning. My name is Steve Willard. I'm the executive director of South Dakota Electric Utility Companies. And behind me is a small cadre of engineers. They're going to go specifically through some of the provisions of the language. I guess probably my question and comment, but more of a question than it may be to Ms. Semler, is that my understanding, and I've run several of these hearings myself and been through the process as well, is it my understanding that the rules that we're working off of in the draft stage at this moment have essentially accommodated most of the requests that were made, or at least in the staff's mind, are the final product, notwithstanding today?
We believe they do. You know, I guess the sign, as they say, of a good compromise is neither party feels completely satisfied. And I guess that's what we intended to do with these rules, is to reach something in the middle. And all of the notes from all those workshops, the positions each party had, along with staff's final recommendation, are noted on the website and all of the workshop notes. So I would say yes is the short answer.
Okay. Thank you. And I want to congratulate, too, the commission, as Ms. Semler, first, for the work that they've done, and the website itself, because literally you can go to the website and get all the information that's related to this. For those of you that are listening outside, I'd encourage you to do that, because literally everything is on. I guess then probably we'll have specific comments That'll be a little bit more detailed as far as some of the language goes. But my question really then probably relates more to process, because these were the culmination of a process that ended sometime in October. And on some of the commentary that come back, they were very specific and I thought very forceful, and I thought quite enlightened in some cases. Essentially, none of that commentary was incorporated into the draft. And from what I could tell, the short review of the LRC comments, of which some are just nickel and dime comments related to dates and form and style and the like, there's a couple of them that are mildly substantive. They have to do more with clarity. And from what I could tell, none of those have been accommodated into the draft as well.
Well, let me explain the process in more detail. All of those comments that were written, that we did receive and are on the docket, those were all discussed at the workshops. They were resubmitted for the companies to an attempt to, I guess, further their positions once more now in front of the commission. So they were discussed, and they were part of the compromise. They're simply now on the table again, I guess. As far as the LRC comments, those were submitted in a separate process. We submitted our rules to the commission. The commissioners in Rolaine looked at them, made some changes. A lot of them were typos, for which I apologize for. And they then went over to the LRC office. And as I understand it, Rolaine, right then, those comments have just recently come back to us. So I think, you know, there's two steps to it. We're now into the process where we're dealing with LRC. The previous process was simply a staff workshop process in which those comments all were considered.
And I appreciate the commentary, and I appreciate the track. I think that the LRC comments came back to you essentially the same time that the comments came back to us, you know, for consideration. I guess the fun part of today's discussion will be the merits of some of the technical changes that you're going to hear about today. So with that, I think you'll hear plenty of testimony, and thanks again for the opportunity.
I was just going to point out, LRC comments, I believe we received them last week, and it's highly likely that the commission will incorporate those comments into the current rules, I would say. And with respect to other comments, you know, this is really a process where we're essentially allowing two rounds of comments. I know there were comments that were made in the fall by the utilities. We did not incorporate all those comments. But that's not to say that those suggestions were necessarily discarded either. I think that the party should, you know, continue, if they still believe that there's a problem, to bring those up. And it would also give an opportunity for anyone else here to respond to some of those suggestions.
And I appreciate that. And again, you know, this process is such a challenge and this thing is such a monster. I don't underestimate all of that. But I just wanted to, I couldn't let the comment pass without noting that at least in the review of that I did of the six company comments that come in, I couldn't find any that were incorporated.
So you'll find them in the workshop notes. They were discussed in the workshops. Were you on those calls? I don't remember.
No.
So they weren't on, they were discussed in the workshops.
I think we'll have a fun day.
Well, and Mr. Woodard, the comments that you're talking about, did those come in? I mean, those came in post-workshop process. So is that right?
Yes. Yeah, they were written comments that came in post-workshop.
Okay, so presumably interested parties would only make comments about those things, about compromises that they didn't win, so to speak, during the workshop process. So, of course, I mean, it almost stands to reason that all of those comments are going to be outside of the grand compromise that sits before us. It would almost be unusual if that wasn't the case.
It's more a question, I guess, of process than anything else. It's not unusual to take all of the written commentary and incorporate into a draft that you're working forward from. It's not unusual to wait until after the rules hearing itself to see whether or not something else comes up or something else comes up in the written comments that you incorporate into the draft. So I guess my question had a little bit more to do with process, because my specific question is whether the draft, as we're considering today, is the culmination of that work product and those workshops, or if there are comments that are essentially in a queue waiting to be incorporated into the draft. And my understanding from Ms. Simler is that that's essentially the end product. So today we're going to talk about some of the issues that whether we lost or not.
Well, it's the end product that has come before the commission.
Right.
And, of course, those, the comments that the companies then resubmitted or are submitted to the first time to the commission, NERS, now is the time when we're evaluating that. I mean, is this a little bit different than typical because the front end of the process was so collaborative, took so long, was so detail-oriented that there was that sort of very in-depth conversation that was going on prior to, I mean.
At least in my experience, Commissioner, that's not unusual with a technical issue. Something that's a little bit more public policy, you have the fight you win or lose. And a technical issue is not unusual for an awful lot of commentary from an awful lot of different directions.
So long before this stage in the process.
Yeah, the challenge, I guess, becomes once the administrative rules process begins, the formal process begins. Everything that we did before that is essentially trying to get the draft into the best condition that you can working forward. And so my question is, does the draft accommodate? Is that the culmination of the workshops? And essentially the answer to that is yes.
Thanks. Other comments?
Good morning, Commissioner Sarah Dannon from Northwestern Energy. I just have a couple kind of pro forma questions to raise at the beginning of this process. The first comment or a question is that on the I believe the April 9th version of the rules, there were no forms attached to the back of those rules. Is that on purpose? Or are the forms going to be done later? Are we taking them off the table? Just kind of what's the status of the forms?
It was on purpose. Right now we're going to deal with the rules. And I believe the rules will give the commission the ability to establish forms that then we can work in a process with utilities again to finalize the forms because they certainly aren't finalized.
Okay. And the second question has to do with the change, also the change in the April 9th version that took out kind of the electric or the co-op language and put in the public utility language. And my clients are kind of wondering what the purpose of that was.
I can address that. If you go back to the when we opened up this docket, the purpose standards are, of course, based on the Federal Act, and the Federal Act refers to what we have authority over, and who we have authority over are the rate-making utilities. If you look at our very first order in this, when we considered the four standards of the Federal Act, one of the first things that the commission did was decide who do these rules apply to, and the commission decided, and I don't think anyone disagreed, that who they apply to are the investor-owned utilities because those are the utilities we have rate-making authority over. Subsequently, you look at our statutory authority that we put into effect with, again, no opposition. It also refers to public utilities. These never were designed to apply to all the utilities. PURPA applies to, we have control over rate making, the utilities we have rate making authority over. And the co-ops and all the other utilities also have to consider the standards, but they have the power to consider the standards on their own. We don't have the power to set standards for them.
Thanks for the clarification.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Jim Wilcox from Xcel Energy, and today with me is Thomas Yon, an engineer from Xcel Energy. We're here to probably discuss that some of the technical issues that we have concerns with, and we have, I suppose, three or four what we consider to be really important matters we'd like to discuss, and then we have, you know, another seven or eight, I suppose, lesser importance. Jumping around a little bit. Also with us today is Dave Hageman, an engineer from Xcel Energy. And then we have others from other companies. Northwestern has technical people here, too, that probably want to weigh in on some of these issues. So I'm not quite sure about the process here, if we're going to take these by issue by issue. So if we have comments on a particular issue and then we let others to speak to that same issue, or do we want to have all of our issues laid out first? I'm not quite clear.
Yeah, number one, I'm open to suggestions, but I thought, Mr. Wilcox, we'd let each individual person come up and state their commentary. There may be a time when we figure out we're getting so in-depth into one particular rule that we may just want to set that aside and focus on that and take other commentaries on that. If you know in advance of particular issues you think are really going to be, you may know, let me put it this way, you certainly know the hot buttons better than I do at this point. Are there those we should pull out?
I expect that that's the case right now. I think we'd want to start with a three or four more important issues here and then probably let others have a chance to weigh in on those, on each of those.
So if those three or four are going to be of great interest to everyone, Mr. Wilcox, does it make sense to not take all your comments now?
That's what I'm suggesting.
Okay, so let's start first by identifying the three or four issues, and then we'll pull the other commissioners and other interested folks and see if that makes sense.
Well, for us, I think starting on page 20 of the document, proposed rule number 2010-3615, isolation device.
Okay, hold on. 2010-3615.
Isolation device.
Okay, thank you, sir.
That's probably our most important topic for us today. And then in some order, I'm not sure, on page 59, we have proposed rule 2010-3665, monitoring.
Okay.
And then on page 41, we would have proposed rule 2010-3642, tier 3 interconnection. And a whole discussion around tiers, how many tiers are necessary, I think. And the fourth on my list, not necessarily in that order, I suppose, but page 25, proposed rule 2010-3624, interconnection facilities deposit. So I think those are probably our top four. And then later we have other lesser matters, I think. But,
since you brought it up, and I think it's a good suggestion, we'll see what Commissioners Hansen and Colbeck think about it. But let's pull those four aside. Pull those out. And okay, Commissioner Colbeck?
Yes, sir.
Any objection to that? Ms. Semler? Mr. Fulham?
No, I think that'd be a good idea. I agree that those are some of the
Sorry to interrupt. All right, first up then for discussion, 2010-3615, isolation device.
I'm going to turn it over to my subject matter expert, Mr. Yan.
Electric distribution disconnect device is considered an essential safety device. When you're dealing with these types of devices, the distributed generation, you have a source. The distribution system is designed as a radial system, and only lately have these additional sources been added in. The protection practices, rules, are all based on the historic radial nature. When you disconnect something, you expect it to be dead. We feel that the disconnect device is an essential device to have available to disconnect these units. I believe there is general agreement on the larger units to have this device. The discussion at this point is on these 10 kW and smaller Tier 1 devices. In our other territories that we serve, they have the disconnect device as a requirement. The sole exception to this has been Colorado. There have become so many photovoltaic devices that everybody has finally become familiar with it and have begun working through the issues, and they recently in Colorado waived the disconnect device. The other areas, including South Dakota, have so few that these are still a rarity. We feel these rules need to evolve with the familiarity, equipment, and rules that are out there. We don't think South Dakota is anywhere close to that yet. For Colorado, for example, Xcel Energy has 1.3 million customers. Of those, almost 4,000 have residential solar devices.
Let me take a shot at this time. Commissioners, if I could take another approach to this issue, our understanding of the rule as it's written is that it would allow a small generator to use the meter itself as a disconnecting device. There would not be a separate switch that would allow utilities or them, the customer, to disconnect that small wind generator, for example, unless you physically take the meter and pull the meter out. Now, the companies, Xcel Energy, I believe there are two issues with this. First, it's a safety matter, that depending on the load, the amount of current that's flowing through that meter at the time, as you pull that meter out, that current tends to continue itself, and you have to pull hard to break it, and there are conditions and times when that could cause a flash of electricity and a flame, I guess, to injure the person who's pulling that meter. So we consider this to be a serious safety matter. And we really are, I can't overstate how strongly we feel about this safety matter of using a meter as a disconnect switch. It's just not really acceptable to us. But then there is another customer service matter that typically in a small distributed generator, say a farmer that has a small windmill and their house and their farm is also served electricity through this same meter. So now say we have a problem with this wind machine on their farm, and we have to go out and disconnect their wind machine. The only manner that we have to disconnect that wind machine is to pull the meter, disconnecting the service to their home and their farm. So we're very concerned about the customer service aspect of disconnecting a person's home. They're not going to appreciate that either. So those are the two, I think, serious or concerns that we have about this rule, and we just feel strongly that a separate disconnect switch ought to be required. That's our view.
Can you tell me what other jurisdictions, you said Colorado was the exception, so what are the other jurisdictions that require this for a similar tier one type device?
We currently serve in 8 states. North Dakota does not have a requirement, but we are practicing requiring it since we can. It is required in Minnesota. It is up to the utility if they wish it in Wisconsin, and we require it there. Michigan is changing the rules, but they are using basically the Wisconsin approach.
They're changing the rules to what? To require it?
They are revamping their rules much like you are doing here. And they are adopting the Wisconsin rules with modifications.
And the Wisconsin rules allow the utility to decide whether to require it or not?
Correct.
Okay.
Colorado left it to the utility whether or not they wish to require it. This was recently reviewed, and the administrative law judge last week elected to leave the rules as is to let the utilities elect or not. In Texas, it is a requirement. In New Mexico, they have a brand new set of rules which they put in place this last year for the very same type of process as we're going through here. There, they only will allow waiving the electric disconnect device for Tier 1 if there is a separate meter on the distributed generation unit, photovoltaic or whatever, that could be pulled separately. And this is important because those have separate disconnects with them that can be used. The currents on these very small units are very low, unlike with the house. And even though they're not totally safe, they are much, much safer than you would have in a normal residential situation. In a residential situation, you have no choice but to pull the meter or to cut the loop, neither of which is desirable and is a burden on both parties.
My thought would be to hold other questions until we hear from all the other parties on this proposed rule. That's all right, Mr. Yon, Mr. Wilcox.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, this is Pam Bondrud. I'm the Director of Government and Regulatory Affairs for Northwestern Energy in South Dakota, Nebraska. And I apologize, I'm suffering from a cold right now, so I brought someone else to be the mouthpiece today, and so you won't have to listen to me. I have with me today Carolyn Lowes, who is our coordinator of Generation and Transmission Interconnection, and she's visiting us from Butte, Montana. This is her first trip to Pierre, and she's found the community very lovely, and so it's been fun for me to show off my hometown to Carolyn while we've been here. We could not agree more with Xcel over our concerns about the need for an isolation device on Tier 1. In fact, this is an issue that we will fall on our sword over. In trying to get the commission to understand the need to have this isolation device there to protect the safety and welfare of our employees who are out working every day on lines in our service territory. We actually have had an lineman who was working on a 120 and 240 volt system who died from that low voltage line. So while some may argue that there's a very low risk of any one ever being hurt from coming into contact with a low voltage situation, as we may see on a residential situation as this or a Tier 1, we've experienced a death from that, and we're not willing to experience that type of situation ever being created again. So from our perspective, we're not willing to, we just don't see any way to negotiate on this, and that we think it should be required for the safety of service personnel who are out there. I don't know if you have anything else to add. I guess that'll be our comments for now, unless you have any questions.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Steve Willard again with the Electric Utility Companies, and I won't belabor the point because I think the guys before me made it well, but I have in front of me the written comments that were submitted in October by MDU, by Mid-America, and by Otter Tail. In the short version of each, MDU, a disconnect switch should be required for all generator connections to ensure safety for utility operating personnel. For Otter Tail, finally, for obvious safety reasons, Otter Tail strongly suggests that an isolation device must be required for all small generating facilities, regardless of size. And MidAmerican essentially says the same thing. In the interest of safety, I believe this rule must be revised to require all small generators, but they actually have a company practice to require utility-accessible, lockable, visible break isolation devices between the point of interconnection and the distributed generator unit, regardless of generator size. So a practice we're suggesting would essentially be in violation of their own internal company policy that they've adopted for safety reasons.
Hello, Commissioners and staff and other parties. My name is Brad Klein. I'm with the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago, and I'm very pleased to be back here in Pierre talking about these interconnection procedures. And I would just, at the outset, like to reiterate my admiration, I guess, of the Commission and staff and all the parties of the process that's taken place here. I was looking back at the Commission's order during Kara's remarks and looking back at the kind of timeline and recall being back here in Pierre in May of 2007 for sort of the initial kickoff workshop. And I think the commission had already been considering the sort of policy issue for several months before that. But the contrast between the discussion, I think, at that workshop and where we are today really speaks to what a good process this has been. I think there has been a lot of learning by all parties throughout, looking at sort of the big picture policy questions at that time, 2 years ago, till today, where I think that there's really widespread support for the idea of a standardized interconnection process. And now the parties are understandably kind of working on the edges and the details of the specific point. So I think that's a helpful sort of thing to keep in our minds as we're talking about this today. and as well, I think that the workshop process went really well. There were experts from around the country that came to Pierre. I think a lot of the, for many, many days, really hashing through in detail all of these issues and made a lot of progress at that time. I want to be available. I've personally been working on similar interconnection rulemaking and policy development processes in other states, most recently in Illinois. Illinois adopted very similar interconnection standards that became final, I believe, in around the beginning of 2008. They've had a year of experience with them there. Those rules were built from the same model that the commission is considering here. Of course, the South Dakota rules are tailored through the workshop process to be specific to the needs in South Dakota, but the baseline procedures are built from the same frame. And I would just like to share a note that I got from one of the attorneys from an Illinois utility now that they've had a year of experience with these rules, and he sent me an email the other day saying, you know, wanted to pass along some lessons learned from our experience. Having a predetermined set of rules and processes has been beneficial for us and for customers. It eliminates time-consuming disputes both inside and outside the company. If you want to interconnect or if you have a customer who wants to interconnect, here are the rules and documents. Usually there are some headaches with vendors the first time they are installing a unit, but after they physically see what we're looking for at the site, it becomes a very streamlined process that is very efficient and uniform across our service territory. So I think that's also just sort of a helpful big picture thing to keep in mind about as all the stakeholders and parties get more experience with these rules, I think everyone will recognize even more benefit from them once they're in place. I would like to respond briefly to the external disconnect switch issue. I recognize that this is, I think, one of the most one of the issues that there's the most discussion on in the various rulemakings and workshops that I've attended, and I know sort of nationwide it's an issue that there is a lot of continued discussion and continued sort of evolving policy over time. I would note also that there was an expert from the National Renewable Energy Laboratories that attended the workshops here in Pierre last year, who pointed out that this, and I'm sort of paraphrasing his position now, I think, there's a document that NREL produced that's in the docket in this case as well that will sort of summarize, that provides more detail on this point. But I think this expert's opinion that clearly this is not, that safety is everyone's number one priority. This issue was not about a trade-off between safety and convenience or safety and expense or safety, anything else. I think everyone understands that, you know, the safety of utility line workers and the safety of customers is the number one priority. I think this issue is about whether or not adding an additional external disconnect switch actually provides any additional safety or whether it's redundant. And in the opinion of NREL, who has studied this around the country, they've come to the conclusion that an additional external disconnect switch for the very specific type of generators we're talking about here, which are only the very small 10 kW and under that have that have been certified by a national testing lab and have been that include internal equipment that automatically disconnects them in the case of any sort of electrical system failures. That adding an additional disconnect switch there is a redundant and unnecessary step. And I think if you, the commissioners and everyone are welcome to refer to that report, but I think the general trend in these rulemakings is that sort of the early adopting states that have that that had interconnection procedures early on and sort of were learning about how these things worked had an additional external disconnect switch requirement in there because it wasn't clear how all of these new systems were going to behave. But there's a general trend towards eliminating that requirement now. And I think there's even a trend in states that require external disconnect switches or leave it up to the utilities. There's a trend towards utilities with the most experience with these systems waiving the requirement because they found that no one ever uses them, and it's an additional hassle to have them. There's a report that's available, and I'm not sure if it's in the docket in this case or not, but it's called Freeing the Grid, and it's an annual survey of the best and worst practices in state net metering interconnection standards. And this report goes through many different policy choices that states can make when they're adopting interconnection and net metering rules and lists how the different states have come out. And if you look in the appendix, there are a number of states that still do require mandatory external disconnect switches, but there are a number of them that don't. And in the opinion of the authors of this report, I could just read a couple lines from page 29, which refers to the external disconnect switch. It says, many utilities cite safety concerns as a justification for requiring owners of grid-tied DG systems to install and test an external disconnect switch. But the practical effect is that, like hidden interconnection fees, requiring an additional external disconnect switch only adds unnecessary costs and discourages customers from investing in renewable energy systems. External disconnect switches are unnecessary because all inverters that meet IEEE standards, which is the same technical standard that's required here in the draft rules in South Dakota, have automatic shutoff capabilities integrated with the systems. In the event of grid failure, all modern inverters shut down interconnected systems automatically. And a side note, I would mention that the NREL report in this docket also lists a number of other internal redundancies that NREL thinks prevents safety this from being a safety issue in addition to this automatic inverter. This Freeing the Grid report continues that it's important to note that not one accident resulting from the islanding of net metered renewable energy systems has been reported. And I think I'll stop there, but I guess the point I want to take home is that everyone agrees safety is number one, but at least in my opinion, and more importantly, I think the opinion of experts at NREL and in states that have a lot of experience, they don't feel that this is a trade-off between safety. Thank you. And I'm happy to come back and discuss other issues as they come up today.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Other interested parties on this issue before we look to Ms. Semler, Mr. Solem? Let's hear from staff. You may want to rebut something they say too, and then we'll take from everybody. I mean, this isn't, you know, there's not really a moving party, so to speak, and so we'll hear from everybody if they have a quick shot rebuttal, and then we'll ask some questions. Go ahead.
I guess I just want to give the commission some history on this item and an idea of how the rule came to be what it is based on the comments we did receive from utilities. You have to look to the definition of what a Tier 1 interconnection is. And a Tier 1 interconnection must be inverter-based. That's the first important point. Second, the electric nameplate capacity was originally set at 25 kilowatts. And we reduced that to 10 based on company. This is part of the compromise that occurred because the same issues came up, and we understand safety is so important. So those are the 2 points. First, just in the very definition of a Tier 1 interconnection. Tier 1 is the only sort of connection that an isolation device is not required according to these rules. So then moving into some of the research that's been done specifically by the National Renewables Energy Laboratory, as was just cited, the research that I'm referring to was written by Mr. Coddington, who was at our first workshop in Pierre. In any event, the National Electric Code requires that an inverter de-energize its output upon loss of utility voltage and remain in that state until utility voltage has been restored. The point being, Tier 1 requires inverters. Inverters are required by the National Electric Code to de-energize. So safety is very important. And based on the research that's done and based on the compromise that occurred throughout the workshop process, staff had that in mind when this rule was written.
Brief additional comments before we move to questions. Mr. Wilcox.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Jim Wilcox again, XL Energy. In our testimony, we had addressed this issue and reiterate, I guess, that we understand that Mr. Coddington and the NREL had provided information that says, and Kara read, that I'm going to read it again. The National Electric Code requires that an inverter de-energize its output upon loss of utility voltage and remain in that state until utility voltage is restored. However, that does not ensure that the inverter will perform its duty, its task, as designed and expected. We feel very strongly that a visible disconnect switch is a more appropriate way to maintain the safety of a power system, and that is one of our basic rules in our safety practices, that we do not rely on these automatic devices. We have that the only way for us to know for sure that equipment is isolated and safe to work on is that there's a safety switch or some manual device that's visible and can be visibly tripped and disconnected. And so we just believe that these automatic devices are, although they're probably very reliable, we're not comfortable enough to rely on them for our own safety purposes. So, and we think that they subvert our own safety rules. So we just feel very strongly that a visible disconnect device is important.
We'll move to questions then. Yeah, no, go ahead, please.
Again, I would like to concur with everything Jim said and echo that.
And I'm sorry, we know, and it's, is it Ms. Lowe's?
Ms. Lowe's, that's
yeah,
right.
That's great. Let's go ahead and have you say your name again just so that those listening on the Internet or the audio transcript people can know who's talking. Thanks.
Okay, Carolyn Lowe's, Coordinator of Generation Interconnection for Northwestern Energy. And I would like to echo what Jim said, and we clearly need to have a visible isolation device. We've talked to several within our industry, again, having the death, you know, and working at a residential home or on low voltage, but we have clearly talked to them and they don't consider the meter a safe device. They want to know they have disconnected and have completely de-energized the interconnection unit before working on it. And again, we have proposed in our notes earlier that you consider IEEE 1547 section 4.1.7 that supports utilities requirements for disconnect switch as stated below, which we had provided the definition and clearly identified the need for the isolation device. So redundancy is something we are definitely in support of, having both the meter and the isolation device, because safety, again, is our number one concern for both the residential or the homeowners as well as the employees of our utility.
Jim Wilcox again, XL Energy. I neglected to add that one other point we wanted to make, that these disconnect devices aren't not that expensive. We think about a $200 deal, so we just don't think it's that big of an expense.
Others? Well, I mean, let's start right there, and we know that cost is the least important, but it, since you brought it up, Mr. Wilcox, I mean, does anybody else have numbers that other than 200? I mean, is that a decent ballpark for the commission to be working from? Okay. Does anybody have any information on failure rate with these internal automatic shutoff devices? Anybody have any idea? Okay. For Mr. Yon or Mr. Wilcox, I think Excel has Mr. Wilcox, you stated how important this is to Excel, although the procedure is different in Colorado. Is that right? Am I understanding Mr. Yon right, that for Tier 1 type interconnections, they may use a different standard or call it something different, but for small DGs, such an external device is not required. Is that the case?
This is Thomas Yon. In Colorado, what you call Tier 1, they call Level 1. It has virtually identical requirements. While we have the familiarity at this time to feel comfortable in Colorado just by sheer level of experience and training of field personnel to let this happen, we are not confident that it will always be so.
And so, and I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. John. So, is it that Excel has changed their internal policy here in Colorado, or is it that the commission or some other regulatory entity in Colorado has said you may not require an external disconnect for Level 1?
In the review process for the updating of the Colorado rules that just took place, we did an internal review and decided at this point we had reached the maturity level in Colorado only to allow waiving that for the time being. I would like to point out that there is not universal industry confidence in the reliability of these devices. Because of this, there are a number of national major studies looking at how they behave and whether they will still reliably disconnect when you start getting higher concentrations or higher penetration levels of these devices. And they would not be spending these millions of bucks investigating this if there was total confidence in the future on this one.
So, Mr. Yon, when you said that people decided they were comfortable with a waiver, was that an internal company change of, or you're talking the commission, the ALJ, or somebody decided?
The ALJ turned down the request to prohibit the switch and left it elective by the utilities. The change in Colorado and Xcel Energy territory only was elective. The other utilities within the state chose to keep their disconnect switch requirement.
Okay, so
they do not have the concentration of them either.
So when you said during your initial comments that, you know, everyone got familiar enough, you were talking about Xcel service personnel out in the field. They were familiar enough with the devices. Is that right?
Primarily. Also, there was enough comfort that the installers and the inspectors were understanding what they had to do, did the proper wiring inspections, that the National Electric Code was being well enforced. Until you have some training and experience, most inspectors don't know what they're looking at. So it takes an evolutionary multi-year process. We're 3 years into this process and almost 4,000 units. We do not have that experience in our other operating areas and do not feel it is appropriate to change company policy.
So the concern would be that in South Dakota, those that are installing the systems might not be installing them in a way that allows that internal mechanism to function?
That is one of the possibilities, yes. The National Electric Code does cover this, and if it is installed as it was designed to be installed and as it was certified in the configuration that it was certified in, it does have high reliability in isolated cases. We do not have comfort that if you start having every house in an area with these, that is still true. And the industry as a whole is not comfortable if you start getting those extreme penetrations.
So, Mr. Yon, as concentration increases, you grow less comfortable with only an internal system.
Yes.
But in the jurisdiction where Xcel has the highest concentration of distributed generators, that's the one area where it's voluntarily no longer requiring an external disconnect. Am I missing something?
To put this in perspective, there is a sweet spot, if you will. You've got the beginning learning curve where you have to be extra cautious. Most of the country and industry is in that phase. There are a few locations like California and Colorado where we move beyond that into a comfort zone. When you're talking almost 4,000, that's out of 1.3 million customers. You're lucky to have one of these installations per block, city block. It is still very sparse. With the renewable energy standards nationally and otherwise that are evolving, and especially in Colorado where there are some fairly significant additional rebates available to encourage photovoltaics, we see that may be a day where we're going to have to put that requirement back in just by the sheer concentration of what's being put in. What we're maintaining here is South Dakota, along with most states, do not have the concentration yet that everybody is beyond that initial phase. And it's something that should be evolved later in a revisit of the rules. In Colorado, for example, the original rules were put into place about 3 years ago and had been in full use for over 3 years. We just got through with a review of the rules. There were a couple of minor modifications to accommodate the rural cooperatives, which are now required to follow the rules also. But in general, the requested changes by the various parties were not incorporated. As a basic statement, the rules work well. They are very similar to what we have here, with a few minor exceptions. They're also very close to what just got put in place in New Mexico. I was a party to that, too. And we're expecting that to work well there, too. But in New Mexico, we are requiring a disconnect whenever we can.
So, Mr. Yon, I mean, again, going to the Colorado situation, I mean, there are always going to be new people entering the installation field, I would think. And so even though the industry as a whole, your folks may have been part of that, the beginning of the tail leading up into sort of the sweet spot you described. But if this is, if Xcel's acquiescence into no longer requiring an external disconnect is because they think others in the industry are more experienced, aren't there always new people coming on board? I mean, isn't there always that chance that somebody's going to wire this thing incorrectly? And we've heard from the utilities in the room that safety is so important, they just would never compromise that.
I'd like to point out that you have three or four levels of checks, and they've all gained the experience. One level, having a new person, will get caught reliably.
Let me ask a sidebar.
We did not, we insisted on it up until we had the full concentration.
Okay, thank you. Sorry, I thought that might be, I may be able to clarify something and I wasn't.
So the first 4,000, we required it.
So walk me through these four levels of checks. And first off, I'm not familiar enough with the electrical wiring, but I'm a little surprised that this internal automatic disconnect requires proper installation. I mean, that's not internal to a device that somebody just hooks up one end. I mean, there's sort of affirmative work that has to be done by an installer to make that work. Is that right?
That's not quite the right way to view it. When you have a certified inverter, they have small disconnect devices built into the inverter. They do not provide a visible opening which is a cornerstone of utility safety practice. They do not have the robustness to take a number of various transients of surges that a full-blown disconnect switch can handle. There are a number of failure modes that can take place over time. Second, when you install a device, it is only certified for a certain specific set of certain combination of equipment. The certification is only valid if it's used with the correct specified other equipment. If you put in too large of a photovoltaic array or start looping stuff together in several ways that could actually cause it to fail to correctly interrupt. You can overload it. Full well that if you put too much stuff on a circuit, you'll fry it or disable it, trip the breaker. All of these things are possible. The current multiple layers look at all of these to see that the pieces are matched up. We get a one-line diagram that shows that it is connected sequentially in the correct order, that the ratings are all matched within the proper range, and other such checks. The inspectors look at this. They look at the grounding to make certain that it is properly grounded from a safety standpoint and for withstanding of electrical transients and other such things. Basically, ensuring that the various things that can cause it to fail are minimized.
Tom, if I might, there are a lot of combinations and permutations of events that might occur over the course of this the operation of these small generators. And the one that troubles me the most, I suppose, is not that when our voltage or we have an outage and the automatic device fails in some manner, it's that's not the place that I'm worried about. The one I'm worried about is when the lights are on and the machine itself is acting up and kicking out voltage spikes or frequency excursions of some kind that's disrupting the neighborhood around it. And so then we send someone out, and they've identified, okay, we think it's coming from this wind machine, and now they've got to go and try to isolate that machine. So their choice is there a visible disconnect switch I can pull? Yes, that's good. Or no, if it's not there, my other choice is to pull the meter. And that's the circumstance that I'm most worried about, is getting into that particular circumstance.
Do you have anything? And I know I've asked a lot of questions, so I'll finish this line of questioning, and then I'll let my colleagues have a shot at it. I'm just having a hard time understanding, Mr. Wilcox, because that situation you described could happen in Colorado as well. And I'm hearing statements that I completely believe from the industry, things like they will fall on their sword on this issue, that this is, quote, the cornerstone of safe utility practices. I mean, I'm hearing this is the holy grail, and yet other utilities in other states or even utilities in this room in different jurisdictions maybe don't find it quite so much a cornerstone and maybe haven't been willing so much to fall on their sword.
Well, the fact we've lost this matter in other states doesn't mean we shouldn't try to continue to fight in other states.
But that's not the Colorado fact set.
Okay.
I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, because I got some people telling me it's a really big deal, and I got some folks telling me it's not a big deal, and I got to try to figure out what's going on. And frankly, the Excel Colorado experience is a little insightful.
There are other main big utilities that have waived it too, but they all have the same experience base.
Okay.
I have not encountered a utility that has waived this.
When you're at pressure.
Without pressure, well, there's no question they did it under pressure. That's true in Colorado also. It was intense pressure to encourage.
Do we have the mic on? I'm sorry, Mr. Yan.
I'm sorry.
Yes, it is. It just not pointed at me. Sorry.
And so you were saying that the decision in Excel was made, and correct me because I'm paraphrasing, was made at least in part because of significant political and regulatory pressure.
That is correct.
Ms. Semler?
Just a quick note of correction. There was some reference made to wind, and as I understand it, wind-based machines are not inverter-based, so it would not apply to wind.
That is not totally true. The older style wind machines were mostly induction generators, and they would not qualify. Because the only pre-certified package that is available is the inverter-based unit, most of the newer wind machines that are coming online are inverter-based. They basically, a wind machine can capture additional wind energy if it, its rotor can rotate at different speeds for different wind speeds. That way, it can take, go into an inverter where it goes to DC, and then the inverter takes it back to AC at the line frequency, and allows the blades to turn at a different frequency. The price of electronics have come down to the point that the simplicity of the induction generator is no longer an economic strength.
Okay, let's take some other commissioner questions.
Yeah, this is Commissioner Kovac. I have some concerns about insurance requirements too, but has there ever been an accident that you know of where a lineman has been in danger with one of these machines?
Within our company, no. And by reference to certain other studies that claim there have been none, I assume that is the case at this point.
Okay. So if we're talking a 100 kW or less machine, if it was to pass, we're talking kilowatts, how many volts are we talking? After the inverter, if the inverter was to fail, are we talking 110 volts, 230, or are we just talking, how much voltage are we talking about?
When you're talking an inverter, as long as it is tied to the utility system, it follows the voltage of the utility.
Okay.
However, because it is injecting power into the system, it can inject harmonic distortion and voltage, temporary voltage spikes and such that can be harmful to your neighbors.
Sure.
Once you separate from the utility, it becomes unregulated and in most cases will automatically shut down because it goes unstable. In some cases, it can hang in and give you high or low voltage and higher or low frequency, both of which are quite damaging to consumer equipment.
I think the question was really the voltage level.
Sure.
We're talking about 220 voltage.
Okay.
The standard, when you're talking this size, they're normally single phase tied into your 120 or 240 volt panel.
Okay. Now, would that be eliminated, the voltage spikes that you were talking about, would that be eliminated with the shutoff?
No, as Mr. Wilcox indicated, usually the producer of these is unfamiliar with the source. We have to end up getting called on complaints to track it down and ask them to fix it.
Well, I guess what I was referring to is if the inverter failed, there would still be this voltage, maybe a harmonic distortion with the high voltage spikes. If there was the shutoff that you advocate for, that would eliminate that problem, correct?
The external disconnect switch does not affect that issue directly.
Okay. During the normal course of business?
Correct.
Okay. I was talking about during an outage when the lineman would be in danger.
When there is an outage, if it does hang on.
It does, okay.
It's rare, but it does happen.
Okay.
Because it is backfeeding our distribution transformer, which normally steps the voltage down to the customer, it can also step it back up if it's sufficiently separated from other loads, that when we get in to look at that transformer and try to figure out what's wrong, there is full line voltage there.
Okay.
Mr. I don't think that's a related issue, that because of the possibility that – any device might be live. Our training is such that we would treat everything as if it were live.
Okay. How about capacitance? Could this is there a certain amount of capacitance on the line after the shutoff? I know we're talking. The reason I ask is the 10 kilowatt or less. I'm just trying to determine if the amount of residual value that would have. I mean, if we're talking 110 volts, it probably wouldn't take long for that to dissipate. But if we were talking about a two or three machine, we're talking about a lot of voltage that could maybe hang on. Is there a danger for that? And would this shutoff take care of that?
First of all, the problem of trapped charge with capacitance is of minimal concern.
Okay.
This is not addressed here. The amount of capacitance on the system does feed into the likelihood that this unit can hang on. That's a side issue. That's why it's possible to have combinations that can be in trouble. But you usually do not have enough other conditions, including enough capacitance, to be part of the problem.
Okay. That's it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Dr. Yan, you're going to have to help me out a little bit here, and I may sound redundant in some of my questions, but that's because of the interesting conflict in what, at least what I see in testimony here. When I give presentations on wind turbines, and people are asking me about distributed generation and whether or not they can, you know, what's involved in putting up a wind turbine, one of the things that I talk about is having that they are going to have to work with the utility and have a special switching device because they want to be certain they're not sending energy down the line and harming a lineman, and they want to protect themselves and they want to protect equipment and things of this nature. In the discussion that, where am I wrong in telling the citizens that at this point, that I'm saying they have to have a special switching device?
If you're talking about a very small wind turbine, you're getting into the same discussion we've just been having.
Right.
If you're talking about one that is more common, like on a farm, where it could be hundreds of kilowatts or a megawatt or more, there is a very strong and important concern there because they can easily pick up and stably carry large areas of the feeder during a problem. So the exposure area is very wide, and additional protective equipment is needed, especially switching equipment.
Commissioner, I think you're correct in your assertion, your statement. I think that's a correct statement.
Is that the practice at the present time in South Dakota with Xcel Energy?
Yes. Yes.
Thank you. It's rather strange. After the first discussions and presentations, you had me absolutely convinced that, you know, if I were a fish, I was not only on the boat, I was being cleaned and in the frying pan. I was absolutely convinced 100% with you that, by golly, you needed this device and the mechanisms and everything. Now, listening to what you're telling us that your actual practice is in Colorado, it's just such a challenge for me. Although from a standpoint with Minnesota and Colorado, when they're doing something, I have an aversion to doing it the way that they're doing it, so maybe that helps you out a little bit. But I'm having trouble marrying what you're telling us and what you're actually doing in practice. In one instance, I won't take it as an insult to South Dakotans, but it's almost as if, you know, if you have this a few of them in South Dakota, it's more dangerous than having thousands of them in Colorado. And I just don't. It would seem to be totally the opposite. Can you solve that problem for me?
It's not just South Dakota. The switch is required due to the lower concentrations and other perceived problems in the other seven states, South Dakota being one of them. Colorado is the only one that has sufficiently rich rebates to attract enough concentration that this was a consideration. And as was mentioned earlier, not all parties are happy with dropping the switch, especially the operating and field folks were opposed. There was a very strong external political and other pressure to do this, which fed into it, and we did do it. Not all parties like it. The operating side does not. And
are you attempting to be really diplomatic here because you don't want to insult somebody in Colorado? What's going on here? I mean, is there a political give and take that took place, a quid pro quo in Colorado that provided for this?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, Doctor. I appreciate it.
I'd like to be a doctor, but I'm not.
I would like
Sorry.
To know. Oh, you're not. Okay. I'm not referring to Jim then.
You know,
well, would you mind sharing that with us? Would you mind sharing it with us? Why, what that was? Are you able to share that with us?
I'm not
going to get you fired here, am I?
First of all, I was not party to all of it. I do know that there was extensive discussion in the legal, regulatory, and marketing side of the company, including with external parties.
All right. Well, if you can't testify, you can't testify. So, but
I really cannot testify. I was not party to most of that.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, excuse me.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
I have a question for Mr. Klein then. Did you have something for them that you wanted?
And I've just got a quick comment to piggyback on where you're going. As we sit here, it's tough when people, again, are saying that this is the most important issue and it's a cornerstone of our policy and we're willing to fall on our sword, and then you get into another jurisdiction and somebody leans on you and all of a sudden a very different result pops out of the end of that sausage-making process. I understand it. I'm just saying it weakens the argument that this is the cornerstone. It's only the cornerstone until you get leaned on.
I would like to point out there has been extensive pressure for a number of years, and it was only as this industry had evolved, specifically in Colorado, that there was any willingness to even listen to it.
All right. Thank you. And Mr. Klein, have a question. Excuse me. Go ahead.
Well, I was just, before we switch witnesses, I just have one question. In your professional opinion, is it possible that 100 kW unit can damage your equipment, which would cost your customers more money to replace, or hurt or kill a lineman? Do you believe that that amount of voltage can do that amount of damage?
A 100 kilowatt?
10 kilowatt, yeah.
Okay, 10 kilowatt. The probability is low. There's a significant possibility of equipment damage, especially electronics, computers, and the like. Most often, people have no idea what happened. They just know it quit working. We do know that in a number of these cases, it had to be a shutdown. We know that the shutdown of these things, if they're not done correctly, if they're not functioning per design, will give damaging voltages and frequencies.
All right. Thank you.
And as long as we got a hold of him.
I don't have a question for Mr. Klein after all. I'm going to pass on that, so please go ahead. That's all the questions I have at this time.
And I understand where you're coming from, Mr. Yon. I do understand why concentration would make a difference, at least with regard to comfort level. I mean, I don't know to what extent it actually affects real safety, but I understand where it would affect comfort level. So talk to me about what concentration would be required for Xcel in South Dakota for Xcel to believe that an external disconnect would no longer be prudent or necessary at the very least.
We're talking for example, in Colorado, each of the jurisdictions, for the city inspectors, for the, our engineering folks, our line people, they're actually commissioning a couple of these a month, and just in basically all areas. A few areas, it's as many as 20 a month. That constitutes experience. When you have only one or two in your entire area in a year, which I believe is more or less where most of our six or seven states are really at this point, they do not have the experience. Nobody in that chain of multiple checkpoints is reliably trained, experienced, et cetera.
So, and this is a little bit of an unfair question. So where, I mean, do we have a good idea? I mean, between one a month, you know, or one a year isn't enough, but one or two a month all of a sudden is. I mean, are there certain benchmarks or standards that the commission should look to understand when reaching that level of comfort might be likely?
Since you will be, I believe the rules require a reporting of the number of units by size and type yearly, you'll have a fairly good idea in each of the IOUs of, relative to their total customer base, how much activity they're getting, and a reasonable understanding of the distribution throughout their territory. My comment was related to each specific area municipality and such seeing several, not the whole utility. And you have to, that has occurred in Colorado. It has not occurred in our other states.
And I don't think there's a reporting requirement in here. So, and again, I know you've been involved in a number of states, so. Well, thanks very much, and I know I
Keeping. Well, you have the right to request it. It's in 20.10.36.63 record keeping requirements. The source you can request, I believe, is the way it is.
Well, and Mr. John, I think you've done a very good job of helping me walk through some of this, and I know we've thrown some. Part of the problem being a multi-jurisdictional utility is you get to play by a lot of different rules, and we hate to beat you over the head with, you know, other jurisdictional experience, but I think it is helpful for us in understanding what the reality is here. So thanks very much.
Commissioner, you know, I don't know what happened in Colorado, but and when we're done here, and if these rules are approved as they're written now, I hope nobody in some other state said that in South Dakota, Xcel Energy acquiesced. I have a sense that maybe we acquiesced in Colorado in a similar manner. So I don't know.
Other than there was no change in rule requirements, no commission order, complete absence of any regulatory fiat. And I understand, you know, sometimes sausage gets made in the dark, too, and not just in the open, but it's very different. I mean, it is different. When you do it voluntarily and no other utility in the state does, that's different. Thanks very much. Ms. Weaves, any questions? Okay. Yes, go ahead, Mr. Rizloff. Sorry. I forget about you. You're so far away from me.
Yeah, well, I'm still awake. Mr. Yon, I'd have a couple questions for you. We've been talking about area, but how large an area could be affected by any one facility? I mean, what are we talking about? Two city blocks, a square mile?
If you're talking a 10 kW unit, its impacts are usually confined to the equivalent of the shared secondary and, under rare conditions, maybe a city block. The way the primary is protected with fusing and such, problems can occur that can isolate into those size segments. And that is when it is dependable shutdown that is important.
When we talk about concentration of these units over time, and we're assuming everybody loves a 10 kW unit, whether it be wind or solar, What's an area of concentration? Maybe we can talk about Colorado again. I'm trying to nail this down. Are we talking about a couple city blocks, a half square mile? What are we talking about? How many units would have to be shut down in a given area? You know, a ballpark. I understand it will be different depending on topography and population.
At this point, the highest concentration of these units are in our Boulder Service Center, or a Boulder City area. The highest concentration neighborhoods in that have enough that you'd have one, maybe two units on a shared secondary, and that on a block there might be two or three. That's the kind of concentration we're talking already.
I'm trying to get at a practical aspect. When we talk about experience and as these generators get more concentrated, is there a possibility if they do get more concentrated that, and you've been using the term the company gains more experience, but is there a likelihood that your service people are not going to want to go around each and every facility and start flipping switches every time there's an occurrence where that may be possible?
It is well known nationally that during an emergency, it is rare that it is felt necessary to flip these switches. That has been documented, including in the NREL document that was mentioned. It is occasionally done, and it's when it's occasionally needed is the issue at hand here. Standard safety practices, if properly followed, should keep people out of trouble. But stuff happens.
This is an entirely speculative question, but if the commission adopts the rule as proposed, do you expect your servicemen will go around and start pulling meters anyway?
We have had to pull a couple of meters, we've actually disconnected a couple of units for non-emergency situations, such as in Colorado, as Jim has mentioned.
Instead of relying on the inverter?
There are two issues. We've not had one where there's been a direct backfeed emergency situation where we've opened the switch. There have been a couple of situations where the inverters were causing problems. The parties did not wish to cooperate, so instead of totally shutting off the house, we flipped the switch until they fixed their equipment.
Thank you. If it's okay, I would have a couple questions for Mr. Klein as well.
Thank you. And if there is time, I have a couple just real brief responses to some of the commissioners' other questions that came up too that I can address.
I forgot the title on the best and worst practices report that you referenced.
I'll just interrupt real quick and just let everybody know that I know some of the lines of questioning have been directed toward one party, but if others have comments, just like Mr. Klein noted, we'll certainly take those here in a little bit.
The title of that document is called Freeing the Grid. It's a publication that's issued annually by a coalition of various renewable energy, the Interstate Renewable Energy Council, Network for New Energy Choices, and some other organizations that do an annual survey of state policy on interconnection and net metering. The particular issue that I was reading from was the October 2008 edition, and it's available on the website.
I guess my question is, what would their would they have a motivation to find anything other than that conclusion?
All of these organizations are proponents of renewable energy, and I think specifically solar energy. So I think that the motivation of the organizations is to promote policies that would reduce barriers to additional renewable energy.
And barriers would be another word for cost.
Certainly.
Okay, with that said, we have a 10 kW or smaller unit. Could be solar, could be wind. I don't know. Could be someone riding an exercise bike, I suppose. But To what extent does $200 factor into the overall setup cost of these facilities?
I'm not an expert on the finances of these systems, but from what I understand, based on the discussions in other rulemaking venues that I've participated in, that for the very small customers that are the very small generators that we're talking about here, the 10 kW and under, the relative cost becomes very important for them because a lot of these generators operate on very small margins and very small payback periods. So,
excuse me, I understand the small margins. A lot of them probably operate at a loss as far as that goes, but I guess I'm asking what's the relative size of $200 compared to the other investment they're going to have to undergo to install these facilities?
I'm not sure on that. I think that the cost of the entire solar system itself can be several, you know, thousands of dollars. So the $200 itself could be a relatively small piece of that. I think some of the concern with the external disconnect requirement is that depending on what the utility requires, you have the cost of the switch itself, you have the cost of the installation, someone to do it, and then depending on the configuration of the site, to get that switch in a place where it's accessible, you know, may require additional conduit or taking out, you know, putting it in a place where you can get to it. And in certain circumstances, that could potentially add up to a more significant cost. I think that the overall thrust of the concern is that if there are costs for small generators, that if this was a real safety concern, it would absolutely be worth the price to pay for whatever it would be if it was a safety concern. I think that the motivation here is that given documentation that there's never been a safety incident that's been documented with tens of thousands of these in place, and that many of the largest utilities with the most experience with these are voluntarily dispensing with the requirement, that redundant costs should probably be eliminated as a matter of policy, especially where they could affect someone's choice of whether or not to install one of these systems.
And I understood that point before. I mean, really, when it's all said and done, they're just trying to shed $200 plus whatever the installation is because, I mean, frankly, people just don't want to spend any more than they have to, and I understand that. I'm that way myself. But just it would be nice to know what percentage of cost we're talking about. You said a few thousand. Could that mean 5 or 10, you know?
I'm sure there is someone in this room, and Mr. Yon or others, that would have like an average cost of a small 10K or under solar system. I don't have it at the top of my tongue.
Thank you.
Mr. Klein, you did mention that a number of the largest utilities are voluntarily doing away with this requirement. Then you mentioned some statistics from the report that you cited.
Sure.
Although I think you can kind of have three different buckets. I mean, those state rules or laws that require an external disconnect. On the other side of the spectrum are those that forbid it from being required by a utility. And then the middle, which is sort of utility choice.
Sure.
Do you have any idea of how those three buckets work? And then, in particular, in the middle bucket, some explanation of what the voluntary activity looks like.
I have a general idea just looking at the appendix of this report, not from personal experience, but I think that the three-bucket idea is correct. I think just from my initial scan of this, at least the states that have prohibited an external disconnect switch right now is both I'm just noticing New Jersey, Oregon, New Hampshire, Florida, North Carolina, and I think that the overall, in addition to the numbers, there's sort of the trend of where utilities are going and I think or where states are going, and I think that's also mentioned in the NREL report. There are a number of states that are silent on the external disconnect switch requirement altogether, and there's also jurisdictions where it's specifically left to utility discretion. So it kind of is a four-bucket approach. I think there's a prohibition of the external disconnect, just being silent on it, leaving it to utility discretion, or requiring it.
Although functionally, your buckets two and three sort of have the same result.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I would mention the experience, I guess. I'm not sure what the situation was in Colorado regarding whether there was political pressure or otherwise motivating Xcel Energy's decision. But I would note that at least in California, my understanding is that the largest utilities with the most experience with these voluntarily dispensed with the requirement, not even in the context of a utility commission proceeding. They just issued a press release and said, we're no longer going to do this. No one's using it. I think it goes somewhat to Mr. Isilov's point that, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced your name, sir, is that line more, you know, that given the fact that these aren't being used, it was viewed as an additional burden for the utilities themselves to have to go out and pull them and pull the switch or even having them in place. So I don't think uniformly there's political pressure that's leading utilities to come to the realization that these aren't necessary.
And I guess who, you say, you know, many leading utilities, and feel free to tell me, just look at the report, and I will anyway, but are there some headline grabbers?
Yeah,
that you
know about? I think look at the report and look specifically probably at the NREL report that's in this docket, and that is, I believe, over a year old now, so there's probably additional data that you could find either talking to Mr. Coddington or others at NREL. But at least in California, my understanding is that Pacific Gas and Electric and the Sacramento Municipal Utility District both voluntarily waived the external disconnect switch requirement. If I might, just responding really quickly, I think, to Commissioner Hansen's point about when he is going out and talking to people about the distributed generation and what's required. I actually think, sir, that you're entirely right that utilities or that this equipment does require special equipment and switches to disconnect them from the grid. I think the question here for the very specific segment of generators we're talking about, which is the very small ones that are certified and have been lab tested, those switches are included in the equipment themselves. So that equipment is there. It's just not external to the home. And I would also, to one line, one of the lines.
Do you know that for a fact, that it's internal?
It's required as a matter of these rules that the equipment that we're talking about has to be, if you look at the definition of the small generators we're talking about here, they're 10 kW and under as a threshold, but in addition to that, they have to be certified by a nationally recognized testing laboratory to have this kind of internal equipment that disconnects them from the grid. And they have to be, and they also have to be installed correctly, and there are, in these procedures, there is a witness testing provision that provides the opportunity for the utility to witness that installation and sign off on the fact that this is being installed in accordance with all code and that it meets all the requirements of the what we call the IEEE 1547 technical standard, which is the standard that's in the draft procedures here. So, yes, that equipment, the 10 kW and under, that is certified, that's when you hear the term inverter-based, that inverter is the piece of equipment that is designed to disconnect it from the grid automatically in the event of any kind of system failure. And I believe, Commissioner Kolbeck, you raised the point about some of your questions about the sort of the larger generators, level two, level three, larger wind generators, et cetera. All of those do require an external separate disconnect switch under these rules. So there is for any of those types of larger generators, The current draft of the procedures does require them to have the additional disconnect, even if they are an inverter-based piece of equipment. So it's sort of a redundant layer of safety. So we're only talking about those very small.
So, Mr. Klein, you know, if I'm going to jump up and down and yell about inconsistency for, you know, one party, I should probably do it for all. If the internal safety mechanisms are not sufficient for Tier 2, 3, and 4, why should we believe they're sufficient for Tier 1?
I think that's an outcome of sort of the negotiations and sort of the compromises that have come in. I think that the parties that generally support renewable energy would agree with you that these are redundant, that it's not required for inverter-based equipment that's larger than 10 kW, that you could go much larger and there'd be no safety problem at all. I think the reason that it's being discussed at a 10 kW level here is the outcome of the workshop process and discussions and the need to just sort of make compromises in the process. So it was just the utilities said, okay, you know, well, we can live with it maybe in some states if it's small. And proponents of more renewable energy said, okay, well, you know, I guess we could live with having the requirement for these larger generators if the utilities feel strongly about it. And I think that is especially the case because for these larger generators, the additional cost of that equipment becomes a much smaller fraction of the overall cost of the system, so it's not as much of a barrier. I think the major concern is that for the very small generators, this represents this could make the difference between whether someone does an installation or not.
Thanks. Other questions for Mr. Klein or others? Others who want to respond to any lines of questioning that any commissioner has brought up, or Mr. Islov or Ms. Wiest? Mr. Klein, you got Mr. Willard sneaking up behind you,
sure.
So maybe.
You can stay
no, that's okay.
Yeah, good morning again, Steve Willard. I just would remind the commission, and I think it's all fairly obvious where we're at, essentially the position of NARAL and the Environmental Law and Policy Center, and I think staff in this case, is that these devices are redundant and that they're expensive. So to suggest that the compromise is that we've said that we're okay with foregoing the devices on the 10 kW, I think isn't entirely accurate, because I would remind the commission that each of the companies, probably I can't speak to the strenuousness during the workshop process, but certainly in that point where we've been asked to submit written comments, each of the committees or the companies submitted a comment that said, please, for obvious safety reasons, require the devices. So, and I guess, in a way, and it's kind of circular for me, and I'll close with that, is part of the reason I asked the process question at the beginning, because as an outsider and reviewing the rules and looking at the requirements and listening to the testimony and reading the substantiation that come along with it, it seemed kind of foregone that for $200, that seems like a fairly easy decision to make. But we've spent, you know, 2.5 hours talking about the merits, and I applaud you for doing so. But I guess I just was assuming that it would happen. That seemed kind of unusual that it had not. But I guess that's why we're all here.
Well, Mr. Willard, I don't know that I disagree with anything you said. I would just tell you that there are other utilities in this country who disagree with what you said. And so you may think it's a no-brainer, but not everybody does.
Well, Commissioner, that's a good point. And I would say, too, that with respect, we spent a lot of time talking about Colorado, but essentially we dance with the regulatory regime that we're handed. If the rules are passed today in the form that that they've been suggested, then somewhere down the road we're going to be answering the question of why are you doing it in South Dakota? And, you know, we essentially have to operate with the regime that you establish.
I don't think you'd be asked that, because if we pass the rules as proposed, you can say, well, we fought them like hell, and, you know, we even took them up to the, you know, up to the legislature, and we didn't win that one. In Colorado, it's a different fact set.
Absolutely. I hope we're not having that conversation after an accident of some kind.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, Pam Bonrud again from Northwestern Energy. I just have to stress again, this was probably one of the most contentious issues that we discussed during the workshop process. And during that entire process, the utilities remained steadfast in their pleas with the staff in the drafting of these rules to include that isolation device as a requirement for Tier 1. And it's disappointing that we were not heard. We've stressed that again in our written comments that we submitted to the commission in October about the importance of that isolation device to protecting our employees who are out there working in the field. And again, it's absolute to Northwestern that we have those isolation devices as a requirement as a part of this rule process. For our company in Montana, we would not compromise this either. So, in Nebraska, it doesn't matter because that's a gas service territory for us. But again, this is one of the most important issues to our company as a part of this rulemaking process. And we ask you to please consider our plea to have those isolation devices included or required for the Tier 1. Thank you.
I have a question, if I could. Ms. Bonner, are you in a situation similar to XL Energy where it's permitted to, for instance, do you need someone else to help answer that question? Where in Colorado, there's a similar situation where there's an exception to this in one state as opposed to another?
We don't have any exceptions. As far as both Carolyn and I know, there are no exceptions in Montana to this either.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your consideration.
Well, as Mr. Willard had pointed out, we're not making great headway with regard to time. We obviously do want to, be thorough. I think we probably better take a break. Let's try to make it short so we can get back to issue number two, or rather take up issue number two. It is 12 after. We'll try to be back at 22 after, and we'll be off the web during that time. Thanks. Back on the intertubules, and at least in order, they're not in the order in which you raised them, Mr. Wilcox, but I think if we follow along numeric order, the next one up would be 24, interconnection facilities deposit. Is that, would you be willing to tackle that one next? Okay. You don't have to go first, certainly, so maybe we'll just open it up and say, are there any comments from any parties on 2010-3624? If you have no comments, certainly don't.
We do.
Okay.
Trying to get our bearings as to what issue this is and what we're going to say. I think I'm going to rely on you to start at least.
Okay. When you're talking about a deposit for facilities, we are supportive of that these kind of caps are appropriate for the vast majority of units.
I'm sorry, Mr. Yan, let's go ahead and have you state your name again for the...
Apologize. Tom Yan with XL Energy. This puts a 25% or $10,000 cap on facility deposits. For very small facilities, this is totally appropriate. Once you start getting up into the hundreds of kW, up into the megawatt region especially, significant system modifications are virtually always required. These require usually because we're talking facilities are costing millions of dollars for the customer, we're also talking hundreds of thousands for the utility. Once you start getting up into the multi-million dollar region, it is not uncommon to require construction of feeders, additional substation terminations, and in a few cases, replacing substation transformers, and you're getting up into facility costs of millions of dollars. Having a cap on the larger end of only $10,000 up front, we feel is inappropriate. You're asking the utility and the other ratepayers to take a risk. We would be constructing facilities for which we would not get reimbursement until after we had completed them. I believe the progressive payment requirement does not allow collection in advance, since it's pretty well saying the advance here is restricted to $10,000. If we do not need the facility that we've constructed, they run into financial difficulty and do not complete it, we will be left, so to speak, holding the bag for up to a large amount for a substation transformer and some other long lead time items. We're talking very stiff cancellation fees that could easily take you into $500,000 or up to $1 million that we cannot recoup. We do not feel this is an appropriate risk to be placed on either the utility or the other ratepayers. When you start getting into facilities of multi-hundred kW, you're talking about commercial enterprises. They have professional people involved. They're familiar with the costs and risks of doing business. We're not talking about the small player here. So we feel that while this kind of a cap is appropriate up through several hundred kW, by the time you get into multiple megawatt facility investments, it is an undue burden for everybody. We should not be taking the risk.
Thank you. That's well put.
Okay, perfect. Let's hear some other comments before we dive into questions, unless you've got something just to, by way of clarification.
I just want to know what his definition of a small facility was then, where the rule would be appropriate.
There is no hard and fast level. A very common division point is someplace around 500 kW, where the investments in the system start to almost invariably move up to significant dollar amounts. There's no question by the megawatt level that the utility will have to do some significant modifications, and in rare cases, very expensive modifications.
Okay, other comments on proposed Rule 24?
Hi, this is Carolyn Lose again from Northwestern Energy, and I just want to again concur with what they have provided from Xcel Energy. The $10,000 cap when mitigation is required does put a lot of the burden back on the utility when we require the deposit to be made from the interconnection customer when mitigations or system enhancements are required. The 25% that is outlined in here for any other interconnection facilities, again, would be very dependent on us on the total construction costs. I'm thinking, you know, ballpark right now, it sounds reasonable, but we do have a lot of projects that are in the millions, and we work with our credit department to work on the correct financing or deposit that we require up front to make sure that we're not assuming any of the risk or any of the liability. So I just think it's something that we need to work closely with our credit manager to make sure we are covered and we are not the ones financing the project.
Other comments?
Brad Klein again from the Environmental Law and Policy Center. On this point, I think everyone agrees with the underlying issue that the interconnecting customer should be responsible for all costs of the construction. And I think the question is what's the appropriate sort of security arrangement so that, you know, we avoid the situation where a utility is would be having to support costs for a project that doesn't happen. So I think it might be useful to sort of think about how this is going to work in practice. I think that you have this sort of study deposit and facilities deposit as one piece of it, but there's also the larger agreement between the utility and the customer about how work will progress and milestones in that process. I think some of the rules from the federal, the FERC small generator rules, which apply on the federal side, in those orders, there is some additional discussion of the different kinds of security arrangements that utilities and customers might have, so that might be a useful resource to take a look at. But I would note that in this draft rule, the next section, 25, billing and payment, contemplates sort of a progress billing and payment schedule that happens throughout the course of the project. So it's not just that the customer pays a 25% deposit and then pays nothing else until, you know, the whole project is done and the project is hooked up. It's the parties negotiating it. When you get to the size, these are all sophisticated parties. They negotiate a reasonable schedule, and there's a progress milestone process that looks very similar to any sort of kind of commercial contract, and that's contemplated here in the rules. So I think it's just kind of important to keep in mind when we're discussing deposits.
Thanks, Mr. Klein. Other comments? Any comments from staff?
Staff doesn't oppose maybe increasing that 25% for a deposit for those projects that are above 2 megawatts, and maybe, you know, increasing some of those limits. Again, it was these rules were all developed taking into consideration to the individual consumers that were present at the workshop and throughout the workshop process, and they of course advocated for much lower numbers, around zero. So, you know, it's all part of the compromise, and certainly, to increase it makes sense based on the concerns.
Other comments? I'll have one quick clarification question for staff. Maybe I misheard, so people correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I heard more heartburn with the $10,000 cap than I did with the 25% issue. If that's the case, Ms. Semler, would staff also be amenable to or be supportive of maybe lowering the 2-megawatt threshold so the $10,000 cap only applied to 500 kW was thrown out? So we'll just, for discussion's sake, we'll start there.
Yeah, I don't have a lot of real problem with that. I think these particular types of rules, deposits, and I think they become a bit more art than science, really. So I don't have a problem messing with that.
Mr. Klein, any thoughts on if lowering the threshold to 500 kW would create any sort of a burden in your mind? I tend to agree with those people who stated 500 kW starts to be a pretty big generator. If we could maybe come to the mic. We've got millions on the web.
I want to make sure they get their money worth here. Specifically with a $10,000 cap, I'm not sure what that appropriate limit is. I have no reason to disagree with Mr. Yon's representation that's sort of a threshold where you start to see more significant work having to be done in the utility system. And you, with a 500 kilowatt system, you are talking a larger commercial system for the most part, or a relatively large turbine. So I think that could be something. I have no reason to believe that wouldn't be appropriate. As far as the specific percent deposit, I think it is a little bit. They're two separate issues. Whether, you know, what's expected to be paid up front versus paid on a reasonable milestone, you know, as the work is completed, as parts are ordered, and as they're installed, those payments can be made through the course of the project. I think some of the concern with a 100% or, you know, a large deposit up front is that it's difficult for these types of it may be difficult for these types of generators to get the financing required to come up with a large chunk of money that's going to be required up front before any work gets happens at all. So that's how this is kind of structured, that you pay some of it, and then there's a milestone process throughout.
Great. Thanks very much. Commissioner, questions? Or Mr. Islav, Ms. Wiest? So that we're clear on this, if the commission were to take the Rule 24 as is, other than lowering the threshold from 2 megawatts down to 500 kW for the $10,000 cap, is there any continuing formal objection by any party present? I'm not seeing any nodding heads and not hearing anything. Okay? Any other comments or questions on this rule, proposed rule, before we move on?
I just have one.
Commissioner Brad Klein again. Just a quick question about the proposal you just outlined, the lowering a threshold for the deposit to 500 kW with that maximum 10,000 cap. What would you have something in mind for what would apply for generators larger than that? Would it be something that would be entirely at the utility discretion, or would there just be a larger cap on projects of that size? Because I do think even for larger generators, there is, for larger generators, the expense of the whole project for the facilities is much larger, and as Mr. Yan noted, it could run into the millions of dollars. So if there was no, I think the question of the cap is different than how much of that should be paid up front versus how much should be spread out over time.
Sure. And at least as I look at the rules as they were originally proposed, there was no cap above 2 megawatts. And so with the change that at least was thrown out, there would be no cap, obviously 25% still being the rule, but there would be no cap for anything over 500 kW. So basically 1 megawatt would have the same burden that a 3 megawatt would have under the original proposed rules.
Thank you.
This is probably for staff. Do you think that $10,000 deposit, if it went to the maximum on a 500 kW system, is it even feasible to build that then? Do you have any estimates on? I guess I'm wondering if we're going to adjust the megawatts, maybe the $10,000 needs to be slightly adjusted to.
Well, I don't have any hard numbers. I can tell you what the small interconnecting customer would say and what they did say at our first workshop, and that would be that all, you know, this sort of thing is burdensome. But, they're going to have to spend this money ultimately anyway, and so I think the utilities have a really good, strong argument in this case.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
If there are no further comments or questions, then we'll move on. Next up, numerically at least, would be 2010-3642, deals with Tier 3 interconnection. And I believe, Mr. Wilcox, you indicated that in a more general sense, questioning whether or not four tiers were required.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's the short story for us, is we think that we would propose to actually strike Tier 3 and just end up with Tier 4 being renamed to Tier 3. I guess I'll let Thomas explain that.
When a generation unit starts getting large, whether they export or not, they do impact our system, how it's operated, and its safety, the quality of the power delivered, and the like. Certain studies are really needed to make certain that there is no problem. Tier 3 goes up to 10 megawatts as presently written. That is a size that no utility can see, that just because they don't export, that the present screens are adequate to protect this. Tier 4 allows us to do whatever studies are appropriate. The way the rules are written is that we have the right to skip any of the steps in Tier 4 that is not appropriate, because Tier 4 covers basically 0 to 10 megawatts. There will be a few small installations that don't qualify for 1, 2, or 3 as presently written, that will fall into Tier 4, and it makes no sense to go through all three study steps and with formal studies and agreements and such, which is why the permission to skip steps was put in there. And in general, the utility does not want to spend any extra time or effort on this stuff than they have to, and will trim it down to the point that is appropriate for the installation. We see that Tier 3 artificially puts constraints and hazards into the process that can be eliminated if it were not present. We would study only those that need a bit extra study. And it is true, as it was assumed on Tier 3, that if it passes the screens and does not export, it is less hazardous than other installations, but that doesn't mean that it is not hazardous. Our big concern is, especially on the bigger end, it provides loopholes where we will be forced to deal with problems after they occur, where with a modicum of additional study up front, which we're prohibited from doing in essence with Tier 3, we could have prevented.
Thank you. Other comments?
Brad Klein from ELPC. Just to provide some context about what we're talking about with Tier 3 generators. The idea and overall structure of the procedural rules here is to provide a process for the utility study of all generators that could potentially interconnect, whether they be renewable energy generators, whether they be other types of generation that interconnects to the system, and whether or not they actually intend to export any extra energy back onto the utility grid. And what we were talking about earlier this morning with the smaller generators connecting under level one or level two, solar and wind, for example, oftentimes those customers are using the energy on their own premises, but if they have extra electricity that's being generated, you're hooked into the utility grid and that extra energy can then be exported. And we were talking about the safety requirements for making sure when you export that energy, there's no situations where that could harm a utility worker, et cetera. Tier 3 is a different situation. Tier 3 generators are not the type of wind and solar things that we typically think about here. These are what we refer to primarily as combined heat and power cogeneration facilities, the larger industrial generators that are intended to provide backup power to capture energy from an industrial process. So oftentimes these would be on the back end of a boiler or something. You could capture that waste heat, run a turbine, and use that energy to offset your own electrical need. You still need to be interconnected to the utility because your own generator either isn't going to provide enough power for your institution or school or factory, so you need to get backup power from the utility, or you need to have some kind of insurance that if your system goes down, you can draw backup power from the utility. So those Tier 3 generators, this level only applies to those specific type of generators that are designed not to send any energy back on to the utility grid. And you only qualify for review under this section if your facility is designed in that manner. Now, this idea of having a Tier 3 review process to streamline the utility review of these types of generators came originally from, I believe, the Mid-Atlantic Distributed Resources Initiative. And in some other states, including Illinois, have included it in their procedures. And the cogeneration and CHP industry felt very, very strongly like that this was an important thing to have in state interconnection rules, because they experienced a lot of barriers to actually getting their generators connected, and felt that some of the technical reasons for those barriers did not apply to them because they weren't designed to export power to the grid. So this is a very important policy matter for these types of facilities. And I point out that the extreme efficiency that you can get from cogeneration and CHP has been noted in many places. I know US EPA has a CHP entire section of their office is working on ways to promote combined heat and power, et cetera. So this is something that is good to promote within the state. And so I just wanted to provide that context, that this was, you know, thoroughly discussed in the workshop process, that it is in place in Illinois. It looks very similar to this. I haven't heard of any problems with it being used there, and it's a policy priority for this industry that is able to take advantage of a lot of energy efficiency.
Thank you. Other comments? Staff.
Just again would like to point out that the main distinction in Tier 3 is that the facility does not export power, and we believe that is a distinction that provides for facilities all to their own, and believe in the four different tiers. And it is more of a streamlined process that we believe is appropriate for those facilities that will not be exporting power. Tier 4 represents a more full-blown study, whereas Tier 3 is more streamlined. So we simply stand by the rules as submitted.
Thank you. Questions? Mr. Klein?
Thank you. Just one quick point I forgot to mention, that again, just like all the other sort of tiers here, just because you are designed not to export power to the grid does not mean you qualify for Tier 3. That's just one threshold criteria. You also have to meet the different technical screens that are included in the Tier 3 process. So you may be this kind of combined heat and power cogenerating facility that is designed not to export power, so you attempt to go through a streamlined review in Tier 3, but you might not pass one of those technical screens. In that case, you fall out of Tier 3, you go back to the Tier 4 default full study process. So we're only talking about those subset of facilities that are both designed not to export power to the grid and meet all of the technical criteria that are outlined in the screening criteria. And that goes not only for Tier 3, but also Tier 1 and Tier 2 as well. So you could be a 1 kW solar panel that's getting hooked on the roof of your house, you're inverter-based, and you're certified by a national lab, and you want to go through Tier 1, but it turns out because of the specific location that your house is in and the characteristics of the grid that you don't pass those technical screening criteria in Tier 1. In that case, you would fall out of Tier 1. You'd go back to Tier 4, the default, and the utility would conduct the studies that are outlined in Tier 4 to make sure that it would be okay to interconnect you in that location.
Thanks, Mr. Klein. Questions? I have one for Mr. Yon, Mr. Wilcox. I am being persuaded that there is enough of a difference between a type of generator that's designed for export and a generator that's designed for on-site use of power. So that argument's carrying the day, and I guess I wanted to give you an opportunity to have one more shot to convince me. I mean, what am I missing?
This is Tom Young. There are several aspects I'd like to bring up. The screens to which we're being referred are the screens for Tier 2, which only go through 2 megawatts, and they were only meant to provide a reasonably safe screening process up through 2 megawatts. To us, almost all the serious hazard and possible abuses are in the megawatt region. We have no problem with Tier 3 on the smaller end. We just think it's redundant. On the larger end, we have some very serious reservations because it is possible to pass the screens and still have some serious impacts on the utility. Now, the impacts tend to be on power quality, tending to give problems with voltage regulation and other non-interrupting type of problems. We agree that with the directional power relay and such, that they will separate. But the question is how much mayhem in the meantime, and while they're running in normal condition, whether or not these screens adequately protect our other customers.
So, Mr. Yan, walk me through how going through a Tier 4 type process would minimize the effects on power quality for that type of generator as opposed to allowing them to go through the Tier 3. I mean, the additional studies would indicate those problems.
Yes.
And then the utility would then be able to require the generator to make certain adjustments that would minimize those power quality issues?
That is correct. Sometimes it is strictly operational restrictions. It is very common for us to put operational restrictions on normal customers that wish to connect large loads to us to protect the power quality and service to our other customers. And we feel we have a need to do the same thing in certain situations, even if they're not exporting.
So walk me through how, if a generator is not exporting power past the point of interconnection, how that creates power quality issues throughout the other part of the territory or nearby.
A number of technologies are inverter-based, even at the larger sizes. Inverters, by their very nature, create harmonic distortion that disrupts the power quality. It does not qualify as power export in the real power terms, but it still, to use the colloquial, messes up the voltage waveform so that it harms other folks that are also connected. So they would pass the screen, they would not export, but they would still be sending out odd, but basically non-60 hertz frequencies that would cause distortion and upset to other customers.
So
that's one example.
At what point you don't have concerns for a, and I don't know that you drew a line, but you said on the lower end. And so if it's I don't know what lower end is, 1 megawatt, 2 megawatt, it doesn't create the disruption to a substantial effect. But at 10 megawatts, it does. I mean, where should we be trying to find a line here?
It's a matter of degree. For example, on harmonic distortion, there is an IEEE 519 standard that tags the amount of distortion you can provide to basically the ratio of how strong the system is compared to how big your load is. And the bigger the load, the more restrictive it gets. And that screen is not in the ones that they have to pass. It's in IEEE 547. But in many respects, that is not a screen that we have to follow or can apply, and it's questionable that we can actually tell them they can't do this. When we have a normal load customer, we have a standards in use manual that sets the requirements for a customer to connect to us and how much they can provide problems of this nature back to us. We think we need to have that same ability on these large units, even if they don't export.
So, and you want it on the front end. You want to be able to perform those studies and require those perhaps nothing more than operational changes, although those could be significant on the front end, rather than have the ability to do that after having the generator online?
Correct. We don't want to suffer the problems and possible other customers suffer damage when it is easily prevented with a few extra studies.
Well, and we're really going to dive into complexity here, I suspect, because when you start saying, you know, it's a matter of degree, mm-hmm. and it may cause damage, I mean, that really begs a lot of questions. I mean, by getting rid of Tier 3, that creates burden for all types of generators that may not, that could reasonably be presumed to never cause the kind of damage you're talking about. So now my question would be, is there a way that we can separate without putting that burden on all generators that don't pass the screen for Tier 1 or Tier 2?
Well, there's two possibilities here. First, I believe at least Xcel Energy has a known reputation for not requiring additional studies and causing additional roadblocks or barriers, as they put it, beyond what is absolutely necessary. I don't know what is going on in the Northeast to have prompted this concern. In reality, Tier 4 is no different than Tier 3 if it's properly applied on these very same small units.
And although we're not talking about particularly small units.
And yeah, it's correct. On large unit, it is different simply because we're saying Tier 3 is inadequate for application. Now, some of the original proposals cut it off at 2 megawatts. We feel that's on the high side, but a compromised position would be to keep Tier 3 but put a cap on it much lower than 10 megawatts, such as 1 or 2 megawatts. The probability of getting into a situation that would be a problem below that level is extremely low, and it's something that we probably could live with.
So now help me understand the types of 2-megawatt generators that, because Tier 2 is less onerous yet, so what sort of screens would kick a generator out of Tier 2 but allow it to fall into Tier 3 rather than 4? I mean, just having the Tier 2 and Tier 3 thresholds be the same maybe doesn't allow for many generators to fall into that 3.
Tier 2 has one additional set of screens that Tier 3 does not, because units that export under Tier 2 will contribute to the load or power flows on the existing distribution lines. They have to be under, I forgot the number, I think it's 15% of the line segment loading to go through the screen, and if they're causing flows above that, they get kicked out. And they get kicked up to Tier 3 or 4. Now, Tier 3, it eliminates the line loading segment requirement under the theory that since they're not exporting, they're not contributing, therefore it's not a question.
Okay. Other questions?
Do any of your other jurisdictions require Tier 3 type process?
In our present other 7 states, the answer is no. The recent New Mexico rules that were put together discussed Tier 3 extensively and decided not to include it in the rules. Those rules were recently adopted about last year and put in place.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Klein, any rebuttal-type comments?
Sure, just just briefly, to pick up on the idea of, or looking for alternatives possibly to address some of the concerns that Mr. Yan brought up without going sort of to the drastic remedy of eliminating the tier altogether. I would just like to point out, again, kind of looking at the context of the whole rule, which I think is helpful. Section 45 describes the Tier 3 interconnection review process. On the bottom of page 44, it discusses, that the applicant and the utility need to schedule a scoping meeting at the very beginning, where I would hope that if there were these kind of individual circumstances, that there was a concern about this type of generator, for example, that those types of things could be discussed at the scoping meeting, and the utility could explain, we may, with this type of layout, for example, have you thought about power quality concerns, et cetera, because ultimately, if any sort of power quality concerns occur, I have no reason to dispute Mr. Yan's concerns that could be a possibility. I don't know. I'm not a technical expert on that. But ultimately, if anything were to happen with power quality concerns, the generator would be responsible for that, and the utility would have the authority under these procedures to disconnect that generator. And that authority is located in the section dealing with adverse system impacts. I believe it's section 22 of the... Section 22 of the rule, which points out cost of any actions taken to address adverse system impacts is directly assigned to the applicant. So these applicants, especially these larger companies that feel, that are installing these types of systems, are going to have a big incentive to make sure they're designing their process to avoid any kind of possibility down the road they're going to run into adverse system impacts that they'd be responsible for. And again, these are large, sophisticated customers. They have a lot of experience designing these types of systems. They're going to work very closely with the utility through the scoping meeting process to root out any type of potential problem, knowing that they're on the hook if they don't later. You have the scoping meeting up front to discuss it. You also have, again, the opportunity for a witness test before these things are commissioned, that the utility observes that it's connected properly and can catch any type of problems that might be arising. In the last case scenario, I suppose there's always the ability to seek a waiver from any of these rules, and that authority is in these procedures themselves as well. So I think there are multiple layers and levels here that can address the types of concerns that Mr. Yan raised without having to actually eliminate the entire screen, which could provide a lot of benefit for probably the vast majority of these types of generators. And it's something that they feel is very important to help streamline and get more of these types of systems up and running.
Is there any typical size for these types of Tier 3 generators?
They can be a variety of sizes. There are actually some small sort of home scale micro CHP systems that I've seen now. There are some like micro turbines that can be installed at the home scale, but I think the intent of this section for the most part are sort of more of the institutional, industrial, commercial, combined heat and power facilities. And someone else may be better than me at describing sort of the average size of them, but they can range from that whole range, I think, from 0 to 10. I mean, 10 is a very large system. It would be, I'm not sure, you probably wouldn't see a whole lot of those very large systems getting connected anywhere, but I think the opportunity is there. Under the rules, and there's no reasonable break point below I think what's outlined here.
So you don't know if most would be over 2 megawatts?
I don't know the answer. I'm sorry.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Klein, this is Greg Russell again. And you can call me whatever. I've been called worse. Is this primarily to support the notion of a cogeneration facility without necessarily considering, let's say, the characteristics of electricity and how electricity flows? Is that really what Tier 3 is designed to support?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, when I think of adding electricity to a system, and frankly, XL has tariffs that allow them to take excess capacity and put it on the market and reward customers for energy they save. I'm just thinking, if Tier 3 is just designed to foment cogeneration arrangements, it almost seems a bit clunky when we think with regard to the entire system that, you know, perhaps, you know, considering a system blend is just a better way to go no matter what, because it may be a rate fiction as far as cogeneration is concerned. The output of the generator, the owner will get credit for it regardless. You understand the point?
I think I understand, yeah, the theme of the question, and that there is more. These things are connected in a broader policy context and broader technical context than just sort of this interconnection procedure. I absolutely agree with you that all of these considerations have to be, are taken into account, I believe, by facilities and customers that are thinking about whether to install cogeneration at their site. I think that the Tier 3 policy itself is not intended to be an additional incentive or reason to try to promote CHP as much as a specific barrier that has been identified in an attempt to eliminate that market barrier and problem, so that all of these other the whole policy context remains and people will make business decisions based on, you know, what their return is, the nature of their process, everything else. But they at least will not have to deal with another market barrier to that decision.
And that market barrier would be the cost of the additional screening processes?
It could be the cost, but I think in some cases it could be just the delay, the time, you know, kind of the time is money. Question. It could also just be when companies are trying to get financing for these types of big projects, I think having something that you can go to the bank and say, look, there's a reasonable established process and there's a timeline for how long this is going to take, provides confidence in that the project will actually happen. I think so it's sort of that certainty and transparency issue as well.
Do you have any idea what the additional time would be and what the additional cost would be compared to what, comparing Tier 3 and Tier 4?
It's a little bit hard to compare because in Tier 4 it can take as short or as long as the utility determines is necessary to study the process and to design the equipment upgrades necessary. And so the cost could be as little or as much as is necessary to safely interconnect. So Tier 4 does, while Tier 4 has timelines that attach to how the studies progress, it doesn't have an ultimate timeline for completing all the work and an ultimate cap on the total amount of money that might have to be paid in individual circumstances, because Tier 4 is designed as the catch-all that has to apply to everything and every possibility, so there's no way to put on sort of that exact time frame or dollar figure on it.
And not meaning to put words in your mouth, but to a certain extent, then Tier 3 is a little bit of a certainty that if the company lacks goodwill or is a bit lethargic in the process, this should or maybe wants to charge more than what one thinks is necessary, this is really a break on that process for the utility to engage in those type of practices. Is that what Tier 3 is about?
I would, I think that's an additional, I guess maybe that goes to the sort of transparency or certainty point. I think that more often in some jurisdictions, when this was newer, there were utility practices that people were concerned about that probably stemmed from just unfamiliarity with these generators. I don't necessarily see that happening here. With the utilities that have been through the stakeholder discussion and have experience in other jurisdictions, I think that the advantage of the screening process and the streamlined review is more of a, having something clear in place up front that can kind of make the process efficient.
Not meaning to put words in your mouth, but would you say perhaps Excel for sure, and we're finding it true with MDU and Otter Tail as well, MidAmerican as well, that their familiarity in dealing with wind projects and adding wind projects onto their system should make this less of a concern perhaps than it would be in states where they're fewer and farther between?
Less of a concern to have a tiered streamlined review process?
Yes, where combining Tier 3 and Tier 4 may not be as critical a need in South Dakota simply because of the massive development we're looking at and the considerable development we've already had.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I agree with the premise of the question, and I guess I go back to the feedback I shared at the beginning of the hearing from utility in Illinois that now has about a year of experience with these rules and said, you know what, this actually is a benefit for us and a benefit for customers because we've got the playbook, we've got the standard rules in place, and what it helps do is winnow down the volume of the generators that you have to be concerned about to go through the larger detailed study process, which takes time and takes resources and is expensive for everyone. So if you can identify those classes of generators that there really shouldn't be a concern about, and you can send them through a streamlined review process, Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3, then the remaining group that are more complicated, you can actually devote more of your resources to studying. If there wasn't this sort of break tiered review process and everyone just had to go through detailed study, you may find yourself spending a lot more time studying things that you could have just gotten off your plate.
I think that begs the question, wouldn't that be perhaps just as much a function of the size of the facility as it would be, the CHP designation, where you could designate a size cutoff and go with the three?
I'm not sure. I mean, I know size is one important criteria, but all of these tiers and levels are designed to look at the specific location where you're interconnecting in addition to the size of your facility and in addition to some other characteristics, such as whether you've got the sensitive power relays in place at your facility to prevent export of power, or whether your equipment has been certified by a nationally recognized testing laboratory. So size is one important consideration, but there are a number of other technical details built into all the screening criteria that look at the specific location of where the generators are going.
Other questions for any party or person? Mr. Solem, Ms. Semler, is, we heard from Mr. Yan that on the high end of this category, maybe his concerns are more pronounced. Is 10 megawatts too big, or is that about the right place to draw the line?
This is Nathan Solem with staff. All I can tell you is that a number of states, these rules were adopted from Oregon and Maryland, and those states were using the same 10 megawatts for the Tier 3. So it's not unusual. And these were, at the time we started, these were considered state-of-the-art interconnection rules when we started the process.
Since we started, do we have any reason to believe from those states that they've had problems with the standards and they're looking to revise them?
I haven't had any contact for a while, so I really can't address that.
I can just tell you, Commissioner, that a big focus at the workshops was to keep the process streamlined when possible, and that's the whole point of us having these rules in the first place. And Tier 3 does, based on the expert help we received, represent a streamlined process for a category of customers that could otherwise have to head down a very rigorous path.
Question for Mr. Yan. Mr. Klein or Mr. Wilcox, either of you, Mr. Klein did outline the scoping meeting that takes place in Tier 3. Is there something about that step in the process that you think is not sufficient to allow the dialogue and the discussion about different modifications that should be made by the Tier 3 interconnector?
This is Tom Young. The scoping meeting will address many of these aspects. There's a good chance that there will be enough understanding of what is being proposed and enough understanding on the utilities part to spot these difficulties at that early stage. If both parties are working in good faith, there's a reasonable chance that a good solution or alternative path would be agreed upon.
Thanks.
Mr. Commissioner, Mr. Yan, if I could ask a question, Mr. Yan. Not to put a peppermint in my mouth, excuse me for that. Considering that South Dakota has so few loads, anywhere near 10 megawatts, is it really a practical matter to be concerned about, a CHP facility? I'm thinking of even 5 megawatts or 4 megawatts or even 2 megawatts in South Dakota. I mean, our total peak in this state is barely over 2,000 megawatts. So what are the odds that this really will come into play in the near future, that your concern will even need to be addressed?
One quirk of the Tier 3 process is because it doesn't export, especially if it's inverter-based. The size of the unit actually can be bigger than the capacity of the circuit. That's not likely or logical, but it's a quirk of it. As far as the capacity, once you get outside of the urban center, such as Sioux Falls, the probability of having anything more than a couple of megawatts is low. Very few circuits can tolerate, support, or deliver load much over that level, and as such, unlikely to host any generation unit over that level.
Yeah, I think in South Dakota, if I could make an observation, it would seem odd to me someone would build a facility of that size and not look to export, but that's just an observation that I would make.
Other questions or comments? Well, let's informally get a game plan going forward. We've got at least one other major issue identified by Excel. I believe it's 65 monitoring. Mr. Wilcox, you indicated that at least your company has 7 or 8 smaller issues it wanted to discuss.
As much as time allows for.
Well, we want to get it right. I mean, and maybe you'll determine on your own that some of those are not issues that need to be raised, but if they do need to be raised, then we're going to stick around until we hear them. Let's we probably better break for lunch rather than try to push through. That'd be my thought, but commissioners? I don't know. We've tried to do an hour before. It seems like we never quite get started right back on time. What do you think? an hour and 10, hour and 8, come back at 1:30. All right. All right, with that, we will stand in recess until 1:30, and we'll be off the web during that time. It's a little bit after 1:30, so we're going to go ahead and get started. I believe we had taken comments from three of the four primary issues identified, and we're just about to begin taking comments on 2010-3665, which dealt with monitoring. And before we dive in, does that jive with what everybody else thought we were up to? Okay. So with that, let's go ahead and dive in and see if anybody has any comments on monitoring.
Mr. Chairman, before we begin, we just would tell you, we, like others, we have airplane problems. So I think this is probably our last important issue, and we're contemplating that for the others, we consider to be of lesser importance, maybe more of a administrative formatting kind of things. We can provide those in written form at the in the follow-up to this meeting. So,
well, what sort of a time frame are we dealing with here?
Well, we have 3 o'clock flight, which we think we need to leave here to be out there around 2 was the feeling. So,
well, let's, in hindsight, we probably should have taken lunch at 2 or something, but that's, oh, well, you know. Let's go ahead and do this. Let's take your comments. Is anybody else dealing with flight issues? Okay. Also the 3 o'clock? Okay. Let's go ahead, Jim, and then after monitoring, if you want to do some triage on your other issues and share those that you think are the most important, we'd be happy to spend some time listening to them. And, of course, take a written comment from you as well. But
I lose my subject matter expert that beyond which I can't really do much myself. So, but on monitoring, I think I can take a shot at monitoring.
But most of these other issues, you could do a very good job.
Okay. Thank you, Thomas.
We have to pass on one or two.
No. On monitoring, let me begin. If you look at the language of that section, it's a long sentence, but the operative words are in the last clause of that section, so that it's talking about generator facilities of all sizes with a nameplate capacity of up 3 megawatts. And then it begins, are not required to provide for remote metering of the electric output by the public utility. And we just have an interest, I guess, in being able to have access to that information. As in Colorado, as we've started to accumulate a number of these installations, you end up with 15, 20, 50 megawatts of DGs online. It begins to give us operational issues with things like knowing about our balancing, for our balancing authority, we need to know what the total load is at any given instant so we can manage frequency and spinning reserve and those kinds of things. Not that these machines provide us with those capabilities, but they are, in this sense, they're viewed as negative load. And so we need to be able to provide generation to balance our load, to provide for frequency regulation, spinning reserve, and those kinds of things. So we really feel we need to have access to the information that the generators, the DGs, are that they have, so we know what they're generating at any given moment, so we can use those numbers in that real-time calculation. And so I guess the simple thought we propose would be to strike the not, that they are required to provide information to us so we can have access and know what generation levels they're at. That's our simple first approach, I guess.
Okay. Let's take other comments on monitoring we might have.
Pam Bonner with Northwestern Energy. We would support that as well.
I
And so just for, am I reading this right, Mr. Wilcoxon, that only a Tier 4 interconnection applicant would be required?
I think, Mr. Chairman, our interests are more of a megawatt issue. In fact, 3 megawatts is a little high. You know, we'd probably prefer to be able to have access to information of DGs down to 1 megawatt, I would think, regardless of tier. So it's probably more involved than just striking the knot. But I think it's information about the DGs that are online that we're interested in.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Brad Klein, ELPC. My understanding of this as a policy matter is the attempt to strike a balance between the information requirements and the costs associated with monitoring, and that my understanding, although this section reads that those generators with a capacity rating of 3 megawatts are not required to provide for remote monitoring. I believe, from what I recall, the workshops, but maybe not, maybe it was workshops in other states, that the idea was that if you fell below that threshold, the utility could still require monitoring, but that it would do so at the utility's expense, if there was specific information that the utility wanted from a customer's site or certain types of generators that the utility specifically wanted information about, they could install the monitoring equipment. The cost just wouldn't be assigned directly to the customer. So if that is a way to provide the utility with information it might need in certain circumstances without adding costs onto the smaller generators, I think that might be a good way to go. I think that there maybe even could be a little bit of language tweaking to make that sort of understanding clearer. And then I will have to look back at the Illinois rules. Illinois may have a similar threshold of except 2 megawatts and not 3, but I do remember this issue coming up in discussion in the Illinois workshops as well.
So, Mr. Klein, just so I can clarify, you're saying you wouldn't be opposed to a rewriting of that first sentence to sort of strike the reference to the tiers and instead just go off a nameplate capacity, and you wouldn't mind the threshold lower than 3 megawatts? Am I getting you right?
I wouldn't mind making it clearer that utilities can require monitoring, or they can furnish monitoring to get information at the utility's expense. And then I think the difference between 2 and 3 megawatts is not clear to me. I am not. I know that there was discussion in Illinois, and the 2 megawatt threshold was acceptable as a compromise, as a level that, below which there wouldn't be additional monitoring costs imposed, and above which the utility would have the opportunity to do so.
Okay. Other comments? Staff.
I don't have a real good feel for this one. I would just share that I don't remember it was something we discussed at the workshop. So I don't have a feel for how consumers feel about this or for how other utilities not present today feel about this. But I don't see it as being a real detriment if some of those thresholds are amended.
So some questions. Mr. Klein, if we determine that there is an important operational reason for, say, Excel to have that information because of some complications that may be caused by a number of these distributed generators, I'm trying to figure out why those costs should fall to ratepayers. as opposed to cost causer.
Sure. I think the question is not. I think the question is whether there is, to what extent there is that need for the smaller generators. And I think the general consensus as these types of procedures have been discussed and adopted is that below a certain threshold, that need for additional information, it does not outweigh. There isn't necessarily that need for information from the smaller generators. And I thought, and maybe Excel could clarify, but I thought there was some discussion at, you know, megawatt scale or something. That was sort of where they were interested in finding information or being interested in monitoring. So I think where the general balancing has fallen in these rulemaking proceedings elsewhere is somewhere along the lines of 2 megawatt breakpoint.
Okay, and for Mr. Wilcox, Mr. Yon, I mean, I would have presumed that there would have been other ways, other mechanisms throughout Excel's system that it would have been able to measure and monitor some of this negative load, as you described, Mr. Wilcox. Is this really the best place to push the expense down to?
Two-part question, I guess. I don't know where else we would get the information. The expense, we're having kind of a debate amongst ourselves about that. I think,
which, and maybe on, I'm sorry, go ahead.
By the way this is written now, it says that these folks are not required to provide the information. So that's the starting point we have with them in a negotiation. So then we just don't have any leverage to even offer to contribute to providing the equipment. And some of us are not in a position to do that anyway. So
well, maybe we can break this down a little bit. I mean, I understand 1 megawatts can be quite a little bit of power, but it would seem to me that on spring and autumn days when temperature changes are not unusual, that in a particular service area, that it wouldn't be unusual to have a much bigger change in your load over just even a couple of hours. But there are certainly ways within Excel system that it can determine that we got to get more power on the line. We need to bring a peaker off or an intermediate off. And it seems to me that you're constantly taking a look at your system to determine how much power in needs to equal the power out. And so if that can be done with an active load, how can it not be done with a positive load, how can it not be done with a negative load? I mean, isn't a 1 megawatt wind turbine coming on about the same as a 1 megawatt load going off?
Yeah, that's correct. You know, I sit here. I suppose there are other algorithms, ways we forecast our load. I suppose knowing if these are wind machines, we could know what the wind velocity is and make an estimate. That's an alternative, I guess, of having the actual data.
Well, but even aside from that, I mean, somebody or some things making a determination at 1 o'clock in the afternoon that now's the time when we need to bring on this peaker on any given day. I mean, you're not forecasting at 6-second intervals the day before everything. I mean, there are some adjustments on the system during the day that are going on. Is that right?
Well, we have a computer program that's monitoring, and when I was involved, it was every 4 seconds. It was making an assessment as to what we're to take the machines over the next 4 seconds. You're right that we have other people who are predicting and planning ahead for tomorrow to know when to start machines, when to take them offline. This is probably more of a real-time issue. The economic dispatch, load frequency control matters, spinning reserve matter. We're looking at things every 4 seconds. So we just like to know what our load is, and for that real-time purpose, these DGs are negative load.
This is Tom Yon. In the past, distributed generation made up a fairly small amount of the total generation. With the advent of the renewable energy standards and other initiatives that are presently going on, they're becoming significant portions on our distribution system. Excuse me. What prompted a desire to have a more sensitive level for monitoring for the purposes of operating the transmission system within the federal reliability guidelines was, in some areas, the total of the larger generation units are becoming a respectable part of the total load. These generation units have no obligation to stay on. Most of them are indeterminate and are definitely non-dispatchable. Wind dies, clouds come over, a large hunk of the generation goes down, revealing the underlying load which we have an obligation to serve and which we have an obligation to have sufficient system reserves to cover. If we don't know what's on and are suddenly caught, that means we have to run additional expensive generation, buy power from our neighbors or whatever, when it should not be our customers paying for this. In our Colorado area, it's started to become significant. Right now, in our Texas area, it is a serious problem. The panhandle of Texas has some very good wind regimes, and we now have pushing 300 megawatts of wind on our distribution system in Texas. And that's a fairly sizable piece of their total. South Dakota has the potential for a lot of wind generation. Not a whole lot in our territory, but as to the state, you do.
So is Xcel asking for any distributed generator of any size to have to put in this remote monitoring?
Ideally. Well, that would be ideal. It's not cost effective, no matter how you slice it, when you get very small. There has to be some threshold. The threshold that our transmission people have requested is 250 kW and above. We feel we really need to have real-time access to this information, and we're requesting that no matter what else is decided, that the wording be modified in this section to give us the right to request it and the customer the obligation of allowing us access to it.
So, I mean, Xcel is, as I've been told on a number of occasions, has, you know, owns and buys more wind than any other investor-owned utility in the country. So presumably on a day ahead and maybe even in advance of that time frame, there's lots of forecasting going on. Is there a particular reason why forecasting for wind units that are located throughout Xcel service territory, why that information wouldn't be instructive to how the distributed generators will act?
This isn't a matter of a forecast or day ahead. This is a matter of real-time information. It's feeding into computer programs that give us the real-time things about spinning reserve. And
but Mr. Wilcox, you're using those wind generators, the power you're buying, you're using that to serve a real-time load.
Well, real-time means in a matter of terms of seconds, mm-hmm. not day ahead or hours ahead. This is a more of a real-time issue here we're talking about.
But if Xcel is able to, and I understand the issues, I'm just trying to again figure out how Xcel can integrate what we've been told cost effectively, hundreds and hundreds and thousands of megawatts of wind, even just in its NSP footprint, that all of a sudden the addition of what we've heard earlier today is a very small number of distributed generators in South Dakota, all of a sudden we can't, you know, that can't be done.
Oh, we're not saying it can't be done. We're saying that it adds to the cost. On the transmission side, there are large generation wind farms and such. they have real-time telemetry feeding in and telling them exactly what's going on at all times so that they can be making rapid decisions on what to do. We're feeling that enough stuff can penetrate at the distribution level that it's a significant part of that equation that we don't know. And we would like to have the same quality of information to make those real-time decisions in a cost-effective, reliable manner.
The decisions that are being made in real time are not being made by people. They're being made by computers.
Thank goodness, by and large.
I guess. Yeah. Yes.
Okay, other questions? Do we know costs for these remote monitoring systems?
Depending on what is picked up, the costs can add as little as a few hundred dollars for just plain telemetry across the phone line, up to a couple of thousand dollars. Obviously, for the bigger units, the higher quality is appropriate.
Would that include the monthly? Obviously, you're probably going to have some sort of internet hooked up. That would be the initial cost of it, correct? Not the ongoing.
That is correct. There is the ongoing cost of a communication channel of some sort.
Sure.
A lot of these are phone lines.
And is this monitoring system inside the wind turbine or inside the unit, whatever the unit may be, or is this something remotely?
The actual monitoring equipment is usually installed at the interconnection point between the wind generation, between the generation facility and the utility. Part of our concern here is some of the distribution generation also, as we talked about in Tier 3, do not actually export, and we don't know about those either. Monitoring right at the point of interconnection there does not give us good usable information. It usually has to be on the output of the generation point unit. Now, for the vast majority of installations, the interconnection point and the output of the generator are the same point, or approximately the same point. You're talking installing equipment, though, that is usually or very frequently required to be installed inside the customer's facilities, and therefore we have to have permission to do so. Regardless of who installs it, who pays for anything else, the customer is in the loop.
Okay. Right, thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Yon or Mr. Wilcox? If there aren't, maybe we can just set aside this monitoring discussion and before you have to go, maybe let's spend 6 or 7 minutes if you want outlining your other areas of concern. And if you don't want to, that's fine.
As Jim mentioned earlier, most of these are fairly minor cleanup items, which we feel the document can be improved to be made more cost-effective with minor wording changes. We don't feel these will probably be controversial, but for example, in Article 10, it specifies that we have to have a specific person as a point of contact. That gets to be a difficult situation with corporations to make certain that that person is around. We propose that should be a point of contact. We must have a specific point of contact available, and we can staff that economically and effectively. Another minor point is in Article 17, it specifies that we have to estimate the studies based on $100 an hour. Some of our internal workforce is less than that, and we feel it would be more appropriate to be worded such that we can estimate it up to $100 an hour to give us the leeway to apply what we feel is a realistic rate. Another minor aspect is in Article 55. The first paragraph on page 54 states the specific required studies that we have to perform. We do not feel that it's appropriate for these rules to specify which studies, since the Tier 4 ranges from 0 to 10 megawatts. A lot of these studies make absolutely no sense to be conducted on most of the smaller units. We suggest that it be reworded to say typical or such as these particular studies.
Or may rather than shall.
Or just say may.
On page 54, first full paragraph, it reads, at a minimum, the study shall include a short circuit analysis and a list of things. We would suggest a may rather than a shall.
The one that truly is not needed on the vast majority of the units is the stability study. And that's an expensive one to run.
Good. What else?
We would suggest that the document be looked at to possibly add a clause to address how the study deposits and later the installed facilities have a true-up between deposits and the actual cost. It is addressed that we have to have a billing set up. That primarily addresses Tier 4. It's not clear exactly what process we should be using for Tiers 1, 2, and 3. And we suggest some clarification on that. Most of the documents I've encountered in other states specify at least a true-up has to occur. Another comment, in Articles 66 and 67, whenever there are outages, it requires that we notify customers as to the cause, and it's regardless of size. It does not put a floor on it. It quite literally could end up causing us, anytime ice took down a circuit, tree then fell in a line, we have to go tell every single PV customer why their lights went out. We don't offer this to anybody else. It doesn't help them. It doesn't help us. It is important to the bigger customers, and it's something that we as a utility practice whenever there is a serious problem, notifying bigger customers why their power went out, what we're doing about it. We have well-established procedures for notifying customers when outages occur, and we feel that this language should be brought in line with the requirements for all of the customers. Those are the basic points.
Good, thanks. Let's pause. I know we've got some other folks who have travel considerations. First, I should see if there are any questions.
I was just going to say, Mr. Wilcox, you still plan on bringing those in writing? Okay. Since we hurried through them, that would be nice to have those in writing also.
I'll talk some more about them this afternoon. Yes, I need to make arrangements to have Thomas flown to the airport, but I intend to stay.
Well, if you need to play chauffeur.
I have that arrangement made.
Could you take Jim and leave the other two?
Yeah, would you?
Would everybody leave?
Yes.
Okay. I'm ready.
Okay.
Ms. Dannon, Ms. Lowe's, Ms. Bonrud, anything? We want to be respectful of your schedule. Mr. Klein, do you also have travel issues?
Okay. This is Carolyn Lowe's with Northwestern again. And two of the minor issues he identified earlier I'd like to further comment on. Instead of specifying an estimate of $100 an hour, it should be stated at expected costs up to $100. And I guess I disagree from our corporation or our utility. I don't think we'll recoup a lot of the costs for the engineers and a lot of the managers involved in the studies and reviewing the application and what is required. So I propose more of a deposit that you then true up at the end. Again, similar to what we follow for the federal, require something up front that then at the end of the process, you can either refund the customer the balance that isn't spent, again, strictly actuals, or invoice if you exceed the deposit amount. But I don't think we should just cap it with a generic fee. It should be actuals that we're passing through to the customer and nothing more and nothing less than that. Minor issue as far as trying to notify all customers of an outage or a disturbance. We agree with that. I think a threshold needs to be set on your large versus your small customers or some megawatt determination in that. And it would almost be impossible to notify all the customers if you have a lot of them that are less than 2 megawatts on the system. We have a lot of requirements during an outage, and I can't imagine we're going to have resources available at that time to notify a lengthy list of customers. So.
Thank you very much. My intention would be to go back to monitoring, finish that issue, and then we'll sort of dive into more of the general issues. So let's go back to monitoring. Any other comments on that issue? Staff, any additional comments?
I guess I'd just like to reserve the opportunity to submit some written information after we have a chance to consult with the experts that we used in this process.
Mr. Klein, I'd be interested in your take on this monitoring issue.
Certainly, I'd be happy to do some more research into that and provide more detail and written comments as well. On sort of the cost causer principle, I think that arises throughout these rules. I think that it is certainly appropriate, and these interconnection procedures are not intended to change that underlying principle that when costs are justified and they're caused by the customer, those costs should be paid for by the customer. I think that the policy question with respect to monitoring is whether if something is not cost effective or not worthwhile, whether customers should be required to bear that cost, be required to bear things that are not, that the utility wouldn't have required themselves to do otherwise. So just so there is parity and sort of parallel obligations, if the utility believes this wouldn't be cost effective for themselves to do, it's not good policy to require customers to do it themselves.
I don't mean to put Pam on the spot, but we have a little bit of a difference between our companies on this matter, I think. And can I say that? And,
yes.
Well, I mean, here's Xcel's view of this, that and this information has some value to us, and so that there may be circumstances when we might be willing to install equipment ourselves to provide for that information. But the way this is written now is that we couldn't even ask the DG to do that. They are not required to provide for remote monitoring. So that's where they start, and their answer to us is no, we're not required. We prefer some language that allows us to at least have a negotiation where we could, you know, work a deal out where we could have access to that information. I mean, that's kind of where we're at, I think.
And I don't think on a philosophical or a principle of the discussion on the monitoring that we would necessarily disagree with Xcel. It's just that as a company, we're not in the position of where we're willing to pay those costs. So it's not that we would disagree that the monitoring information should be made available if the utility needs it, but our difference will be that and how this is crafted so that we're not required to have to pay for it. At this point, we've not requested that information with our existing DGs in Montana or the one or two we may have here in South Dakota. So we just don't want to be placed in a position or a box, so to speak, with the rules that one that we would have to require the information and then pay for it. So it's we want it left up to the utility to be able to decide. If they want to request the information, that's fine. And then, as Jim said, if the utility is willing to pay for it, that's great, but we don't want to be forced into saying that we're going to require the information and we have to pay for it too. So it's kind of a weird distinction, but I hope I explained that well enough.
Thanks, ma'am.
So the only change Northwestern would request is that the remote monitoring be made optional at the utility's choice, but that payment not be required from generators below the 3-megawatt level, that the utility could ask for it if the utility paid for it? Is that what you're asking?
Well, maybe I need... This is Carolyn, and, you know, I'm going to state this, and maybe I'm misinterpreting what you have said, but my understanding is the position of our company is that we don't want it as an obligation, that it is something that if the customer or the utility comes to a mutual agreement that it's something that they want, Northwestern will not pay for it, that the customer will. And that's what's differing from Xcel. They want the option that if they want it, they can pay for it, and we're disagreeing with that because we're not going to require it of our customers. So if it's something that you leave it as an option, that's great because then we can decline that. But if you require it, we want the interconnection customer to pay for it, not the utility.
Right, and so I'm just saying if, and I don't think this change would make all parties happy, but if the change just said that, hey, a utility can require it if a utility is willing to pay for it, that at least for Northwestern would make Northwestern comfortable.
Okay. Yeah. That's what I thought I said, but I want to
make sure. Okay, gotcha. And you're not the first person, I mean, I don't speak very well sometimes, so I'll let you... I confuse myself half the time, halfway through my comments. Other comments? Commissioner, questions? So is there, I have to talk about buckets again, but I mean, is there a three-tier approach that maybe makes sense here? I mean, or maybe it's just that maybe we shouldn't make it that complicated. Maybe it should just be a bright line where if you're a big boy or a big girl, then you got to have the monitoring equipment. If you're a little boy or a little girl, then you don't have to. But that if the utility wants it, then the utility can pay for it. And that line, presumably, the differentiation between big and little would be how, the likelihood that you would cause damage is a strong word, but cause disruption or complication to the system. Am I looking at that the right way?
Mr. Chairman, Jim Wilcox again. You know, if we are given the opportunity to have access to information, it wouldn't even need to have a megawatt threshold. It's just if we can write it such that we are, I guess there's a point above which that we expect that that the customer, the DG, would provide for it. I guess so. You're right there. We do need a threshold.
At some point, I'm just trying to figure out who benefits and who causes the cost. If you're a little bitty guy or gal, but the utility is still curious of the information, well, then by gosh darn it, they should pay for it. But if you're big and the utility needs to change some operations so that the system isn't injured, then that's probably a cost causer.
Right.
This is Brad Klein, ELPC. Just to address that point, I think that the way that the rule is currently written is that it's still at the option of the utility for generators over 3 megawatts. So monitoring and control isn't required. However, the utility has the option to request monitoring and control for those generators above 3 megawatts, and in that situation, the rule would assign the cost to the customer. So I think that there's no my understanding of sort of the compromise that's being discussed today would be to simply extend that same scenario that a utility could request monitoring for any customer, but that the threshold breakpoint is only there for the purposes of assigning costs. So you know, if the utility was did request information for those smaller than the 3 megawatts, they would just be paying for that.
Although to a certain extent, request maybe isn't a strong enough phrase. I mean, maybe require is the right phrase, but again, as long as the utility is paying for it, maybe that is a requirement that they could impose.
I don't see a problem with that, and I think maybe on some further research into what other jurisdictions are doing, I could provide that in written comments.
So, Mr. Klein, 3 megawatts does seem like a big unit. I mean, I hesitate to ask all these questions, so frankly, those of you who've gone through this know the body of knowledge you have on this is far bigger than I do. And so I hate to mess around with a compromised position, but 3 megawatts does seem like a really big generator. If you had, say, you know, two megawatt wind turbines that each of them was being used by a different company 10 miles away, you would probably see them coming on and going off at the same time. I got to think a 2 or 3 or 4 megawatt load change over a 5-minute period would have a pretty big impact or potentially. Is that 3 megawatts? Is that the right number?
Well, I know it's at the scale, sort of the order of magnitude that's been discussed in other states. And as I mentioned before, Illinois settled on a 2 megawatt threshold. So I know it's sort of the order or the range that's typically discussed as where monitoring and control are appropriate.
And a question for Mr. Wilcox. Would you need this kind of monitoring equipment even for your Tier 3 sort of CHP issues? I mean, again, it becomes a negative load, but aren't those, a lot of those CHPs, aren't those more reliable? I mean, they don't deal with the intermittency of wind, and does it make sense to require remote monitoring for a Tier 3 that is going to be far more predictable? And I should have asked that 7 minutes ago, I know.
Chairman Jim Wilcox, again, I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't know.
Any thoughts from?
No, maybe that's something we.
Okay. Thanks. Any other questions, comments on this issue? Okay. So I think we're done with. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
This is Carolyn Lose again, and when you talk about threshold, and I'm responsible for all the federal out in Montana, and I look at the threshold for the fast track process being 2 megawatts. So to try and have similarities in the process and the thresholds on the rules and what we're going to require of the customer, we may want to consider that so we have some consistencies when we're trying to implement both processes within a state. So you may want to give some consideration that maybe rather than 3 megawatts, we consider 2 megawatts. You can put them through the process a lot faster. We do have a lot more requirements from the federal as far as if you're in excess of 2 megawatts up to 20. So just for consideration.
Okay, thanks. Anything else? Okay, my thought would be we should probably deal with any other general. Well, first let's see, we've dealt with the four serious issues that Excel raised. Are there other serious issues that people have aside from outside of those four? Then let's move into lesser issues. We've heard from at least one party of some areas for possible improvement. Any other? Yeah, Ms. Emily.
I would just note a correction that staff made in a September 11th filing that doesn't look like it made it into the current rules as we see them. 2010-3664 on page 59, staff suggested that we remove the second sentence, which made an exception for Tier 1.
I'm sorry, Ms. Simler, you said 64 or 64 in metering?
64, page 59. And the reason for that was there were some concerns that it appeared to be a net metering sort of situation.
Do you think that would have any effect on the first issue that we talked, when we were talking about the disconnect? Because in Tier 1, we were going to remove the meter. Does that kind of intertwine with this one?
I don't think they are connected, no.
Okay. Okay, other issues?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Steve Willard, and I won't belabor the point, but I wanted to make sure the group knew that in the written comments, and I know you'll be reviewing those as well, that both Mid-America and Otter Tail at least raised some questions about the $100 maximum cost. The idea being that cost cause, that if you're going to put a dollar in rules, that that's problematic. And so both of them elaborated quite a little bit in their written comments, and I encourage you to take a look at that.
This is Caroline again with Northwestern, and I just would ask for consideration on the comments we earlier provided as far as providing the tier definitions at the beginning of the document. It just makes it easier to make reference to the definitions for the various tier level customers. So,
Mr. Willard or anybody else, can you give me an idea of, and I'm talking about the $100 here, I mean, you know, when you get to the cost-causer issue, it seems like it depends a little bit on if these are dedicated staff, if these folks are only working on these types of things, so it is the entire position is a cost to the company that should not be a ratepayer cost but should rather be a cost-causer cost, or whether or not this becomes a no marginal cost addition to someone's duties, in which case complete cost recovery probably doesn't follow cost causer principles.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Steve Willard. I think probably the nature of the objections is just the challenge that comes along with $100. At least Mid-America posited the idea that an awful lot of these studies are going to be able to take care of in-house. But if, in fact, you have to bring a consultant into the equation, which for the more sophisticated studies you will, and the larger studies you will, that you're not going to get one for $100 an hour. It's going to cost you $200, $250 an hour because they're in demand and they're sophisticated and they're specialized and they're hard to come by. So I don't think that anybody conceptually was really opposed to the idea. The idea was that, first, why would you pay it at $100? And second, why wouldn't you just recover the actual costs incurred? I think both the companies, at least in the written comments, are of the opinion that most of these are going to be able to knock off themselves, because when you reach out to an outsider, that $100 is problematic.
See, and I think recovering full costs for consultants theoretically makes a ton of sense, because that is a cost that would not have been incurred by the utility but for that interconnection
request. Exactly. And
if you're dealing in-house, you may be dealing with a different set of circumstances. There may not be marginal costs. I mean, those costs may have been incurred even without, and that's not to say that they shouldn't be recovered at some level. I'm just saying it is a little bit different set of circumstances.
Well, and I may be far afield, but doesn't FERC require that you recover the whole cost for at least those projects that come over FERC jurisdiction? And it seemed to be that treating them similarly would make sense.
I would agree that what he stated is correct, and even to take it one step further with the federal, is for any of our large generators, in addition to a deposit, they accrue the FERC interest rate of 8% to 9% on top of their deposit. So they get a lot of times refunds in excess of what they provided to us, depending on the amount of the study cost. So small generators, anything under 20 megawatts, it is just the actuals and does not accrue interest. So there is no margin, there is no earnings on this. We're passing through actual study costs that are incurred for the customers.
Yeah, good clarification. Thanks. Other comments, questions?
Mr. Chairman, may I address this issue from staff's viewpoint? I did a pretty detailed study of the engineering costs using engineering labor statistics from the Department of Labor in South Dakota. And in-house engineering rates go from $32 an hour, and consultant rates go up to $350 an hour. So what staff's viewpoint was at the time was because of that large range and to provide some protection to the small distributed generator, we wanted to find a dollar value that on the average made the utilities whole but was stable, so when a distributed generator went from one territory to another, one utility territory to another, the cost would be relatively stable. So that $100 an hour figure is based on a mid-career engineer at $32 an hour with a 60% overhead rate, and it's also based on 35% of the costs being outsourced to a consulting engineer at $200 an hour. So that $100 an hour is a weighted average rate based on that. And, of course, the weakest assumption in there is the 35% going out to consultants. But it was some way to get us a starting point. Oregon used a similar approach when they in their rules when they did this. There's two comments that were brought up that I wanted to make. Staff agrees with Excel's comment that it should be rewarded up to $100 an hour. That makes sense. We also agree with a comment submitted by Black Hills Power that perhaps this rate should be escalated by the Consumer Price Index so that it doesn't go out of date every year and they can increase that set rate and recoup some of the costs of inflation that way.
The rule doesn't limit the reimbursement for just out-of-house type of consultants. It's for any of the work that the company does.
Other comments, issues, or questions?
Brad Klein, ELPC. Just quickly to respond to a couple of the issues raised by Mr. Yan before he left. I think he mentioned Article 10, a designated a point of contact rather than a person. I have no objection to that point. The $100 an hour issue, I also agree, it sounds like, with Excel's suggestion and staff's point about modifying to be up to $100, and I don't see a problem with indexing it to the consumer price index as well to provide an opportunity to keep that in date. The Article 55, flexibility on the types of studies that might be required, I think that certainly could be appropriate, laying out these are the studies that would be typically required or such as appropriate or some kind of qualifying language like that in Article 55. One point where I was not entirely clear on Mr. Yan's suggestion was in his discussion about truing up deposits and costs. I do think the rule as it's written now does provide for a true up of a customer's deposit and payment of the full amount of the study and any sort of interconnection facilities construction that needs to take place. I think the true up is in there right now. I'm a little bit concerned about a suggestion that there should be a true up for level 1, 2, and 3 streamlined review, because in those cases, by definition, you're interconnecting without the full study process and construction. When you qualify under Tier 1, 2, and 3, you don't have those additional costs, so there isn't something to true up at the end. Those three tiers do have an application fee that goes in, but it's not the same as the study deposit or construction deposit that you have for level 4s. So it may just have been something I didn't quite understand, but I just wanted to point out that a sort of true-up mechanism isn't required or necessary by definition for the Tier 1, 2, and 3. He mentioned a customer notification issue about a requirement that every customer be notified. I think that is certainly something that could design some flexible language around to avoid unintended disruptions or burdens on utilities. And then on the Article 64 metering requirements, staff had mentioned a recommendation that the second sentence of Article 64 be stricken. I would suggest if there's maybe a way to modify that sentence or add language that would apply to the specific concern if it is a net metering issue or a potential conflict with other rules, maybe that language could be tweaked rather than stricken in its entirety, because I think it does provide an important safeguard for the smaller Tier 1 customers where additional metering expenses can create a burden for that level of customer. Those were just my quick comments.
Thanks, Mr. Klein. Other questions, comments, or new issues? Right, hearing none, I do believe the record on this is open until the 18th, so I look forward to hearing any other additional comments people may have. And unless there's anything else, we'll stand adjourned. Or we'll close the rules hearing, rather.